Welcome those that are here today. This is a work meeting for the board. I'm going to first ask, and I think the board members all have a copy of the agenda. You're all satisfied with that? Any changes? If not, ask for a motion approving the agenda. Motion made by Bill, seconded by Jake. All in favor? Okay. The items of discussion, they are just information items, so there's no action that's going to be taken or voted by the board. And it is open to the public. However, no public comment will be accepted unless we have a specific question directed to someone. So we start with Deputy Director. Mike Fouch reporting for, or substituting for Greg, who's on an airplane and getting close.
Yeah, he's on his way back from Montana, went up for a conference. So he's in the air right now, should be here about 2 o'clock this afternoon. So I'm sitting in for him until that point. The division update is going to be very brief today because I'm going to leave a lot of that for Greg for tomorrow to cover. First off, I need to apologize for being the only one up here wearing a tie.
I can fix that.
Yeah. Yeah, we can take that off for you if you really wanted to.
It is an appropriate tie.
There you go.
Yeah.
It's a turkey tie, and I've got my bighorn sheep tie pin, so it's appropriate.
That's fine.
All right.
No, it's all right. When you come tomorrow and we all have a shirt and tie on, you're in a T-shirt,
yeah,
then I'll make up for it.
Anyway, the only thing I wanted to cover on the update is the signing of the sage-grouse statewide plan by the governor, which is a good thing, but now we get to figure out how we're going to implement this. And I went to a meeting on Friday with Kathleen Clark, who's headed this effort up, and we started the process of developing an implementation team. And Greg Sheehan will sit on that. All of the federal agencies in the state have offered up their help and will be assisting and sitting on that committee as well. As well as a host of other interested parties. So we're headed down that path, and the division will be playing an integral role in implementing that sage-grouse plan. But other than that, that's all I wanted to cover today, so unless there's any other questions, that's all I've got.
Okay, thank you, Mike. Review of the RAC agenda items. Don or Anise?
Why does he get a padded chair?
Not me. I don't know. I could do it either way. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm just going to go over the kind of the agenda and some of the things that came up in the regions and then open it up for any questions that the board may have and on those issues. Covey has actually a presentation. There were some questions that came up in the central region that he was asked to follow up on. So he'll be giving a presentation as part of this. Any case, the southern region, for the most part, they passed the Bucks and Bulls, not the Bucks and Bulls, but the once in a lifetime portion of the what we recommended. They did recommend a change on the split on three units: the Wasatch, the Nebo, and the Deep Creeks. They wanted to remain with the split that currently exists, which is 50-30-20. They also passed a motion to decrease the limited entry elk permits on the Monroe. And then they accepted the remainder of the elk presentation. And then they wanted to reduce the permits on the plateau for pronghorn to 183, and then that was all the recommendations that they passed there. Oh, there was a general season recommendation to lower the permits, keep them as they are on the Panguitch Lake, Pine Valley, Zion, and Monroe units. So that's what the southern region passed. In the southeastern region, Everything passed with one except with a couple of exceptions. They wanted to have the bull elk permits on the Monroe remain at the current level instead of increasing like we're recommending, and that passed 7-1. The Northeast.
On what unit was that, Anise?
The Manti.
The Manti. Unit. Okay.
Yeah.
I thought you said Monroe there.
I may have. Yeah, I may have misspoke.
We're all kind of old up here, so we can hear things wrong.
Yeah,
so.
I'll try to speak into it.
When I say we, I mean everybody else.
Right, I know what you meant. And then the Northeast region, the only motion there was to reduce the permits on the book lifts from what we were recommending to 25% from last year. So we recommended a 15% reduction. They wanted to see a 25% reduction.
Clarification then, that wasn't a 25% reduction below the number recommended by...
No, that was 25% from last year, from last year's permit numbers.
What would that take it to then?
No, I haven't done the math. I'll tell you pretty quick.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. Central region, they also recommended to pass Yuba's recommendation to keep those three units, the West Desert, the Deep Creeks, and the Wasatch, at 50-30-20 instead of what we have recommended. And our recommendation was the split would be 65-25-15, which is in accordance with the statewide plan. And then they passed a motion for the balance of the recommendations. The northern region, they also voted to support Yuba's recommendation of the 50-30-20 split. There was also a motion that limited entry elk on the south cache would remain at 2012 levels, and the north cache would be reduced to 70 permits. And then there was a motion that the Wildlife Board would approve the remainder of the presentation, and that was unanimous. On antlerless, probably less issues there. There was a motion to accept the recommendations in the southern region. That motion was amended to increase the season dates on the Paunsagunt to go until January 31st, and that passed 7-3. And then there was a second motion to accept the division's recommendation on antlerless pronghorn permits, with one exception to increase the plateau unit to 750, and that passed 8-2. And then they accepted the rest of the antlerless, and that was unanimous. In the northern region, they wanted to keep the antlerless elk permits on the cache at the 2012 level, and that passed unanimous. And recommend the Wildlife Board approve the remainder of the presentation. And the southeast region, northeast region, and central region basically passed everything as presented on the bucks and bulls, on the antlerless stuff. That's kind of how the racks went. Overall, I think they went fairly well. There was a lot of good conversation that went on, a lot of good input. Obviously, there were a few changes recommended, but overall, most of it went over pretty well. I'd be glad to elaborate on any questions you might have.
Questions? Nisa, both in the RAC meetings and then on the side, I heard some comments on antelope that were pretty intriguing. Question was transplants versus that huge harvest down on the plateau.
Sure.
Are there willing recipients, regions that would like to get some antelope to augment? And
sure.
Is that a acceptable, or do you support that?
Yeah, we certainly do support transplants. We didn't want to go into doing a harvest and a transplant the first year we started harvesting on that unit. We wanted to kind of wait and see how the harvest success was, because in the past, I mean, we could stand the harvest and an additional transplant, and we still would be okay on that population because it does tend to increase quite rapidly. But for this year, we recommended just permits, and then if we see the right amount of harvest success, we would move forward with a transplant next year.
I think you made a comment at the Southern Iraq meeting that 500 was fairly minimal, and
yeah, we could stand a transplant
on
top
that,
of it.
So you could support a transplant on top of that, right, which would also kind of match the recommendation for numbers.
The one thing we want to see before that happens, though, is what production looks like, and obviously we don't have that number yet. That's when we do our September classifications. So that would tell us whether we can do a transplant on top of it, and then how many we could transplant on top of it. So that's the reason we're waiting to see.
So something like in a motion tomorrow, something like an additional transplant for 250 if the population census supports it?
Yeah, that would be fine.
Completely agreeable to the division?
Yeah, I mean, places we need pronghorn, if we have a source, we would like to put them there. So it's something we're always looking to do.
Would you ask one more question? Are there more, how many regions would want how many antelope?
You know, we haven't transplanted antelope in a couple of years, so there are some regions. I can think of off the top of my head three regions that already would like pronghorn. And so there's places we can put them for sure. These are usually low production populations that are drought stricken a lot of the years, so they're just bolstering populations slightly.
Would you do that this next winter, or would you
usually
be
a
year wait?
Usually we end up doing a December capture if we decide to do it this year. We're kind of thinking we're not going to do one this year just to kind of see how things play out, but we certainly could ramp up and do it this year if we needed to. But yeah, usually it's a December capture.
When that's not built into your budget, maybe it is, but where do you come up with the funding to do something?
We do
like
have
that?
Some conservation permit money for pronghorn that we can use for that, and that's already there, and it's ready to go. And if we were short, we could also ask the groups to pitch in as well, and a lot of times they're glad to do those kind of things. So,
go ahead, Jake.
Anise, on the Parker unit with the die-off that we had a couple of years ago, do you have an idea, or does the biologist have an idea of what the age structure on those animals are now?
Of the animals that died?
No, on the ones that are alive.
No, we don't really have very good data on age structure, just because we don't age the animals. We have all age structures in the population, obviously. If we have, when we do the classifications, we know how many adult bucks there are, but this year's classification will let us know what the fawns and bucks and all that is. That's why we're waiting to do that, to see what the breakdown is.
Well, and that was my follow-up question, is if that would come along later this fall. But with that die-off that we had a couple of years, wouldn't it be safe to say that the majority of that herd is probably fairly young?
No, actually, it's the opposite. It's usually the younger animals that succumb. The older animals stay in the population. So what you're probably missing is the yearlings of 2 years ago. So there's probably not a lot of two-year-olds in the population, but there's older animals and younger animals.
Anise, you said, referring to question, answering Mike's question, if we need to, you could transplant this year. Do you have some parameters that defines what need to?
Well, as I mentioned before, when we do classifications, if we see, high production, like, 80 plus fawns per 100 does, then the harvest we're recommending, would be insufficient to keep that population where it needs to be, and then that's when we would do a transplant.
Okay. John.
I was just going to ask you, Niece, a couple of concerns I've been asked about. With just two or three years ago, we did the emergency closure during the hunt and whatnot, and then we've had some permits since then. And obviously the population bounces back pretty quick. The guys I'm hearing from are worried that with the amount of buck tags were is being proposed there, that that would put a lot of pressure on the older age class animals that are left and leave a lot of those tags forced into shooting two-year-old bucks.
Yeah.
Is that...
That's probably not that big of an issue. Actually, there's not going to be a lot of two-year-old bucks because we had a pretty big die-off 2 years ago, so the fawns are not there to be 2 years old this year.
So wouldn't that be a concern, though, that we're putting that many tags on the older animals that
are
there?
It would be if we didn't have so many bucks on that unit. It's fairly buck-heavy because we've transplanted so much in the past, and most of the transplants have been does. So, you know, I can maybe ask the region to comment, but I'm pretty sure the buck-to-doe ratio is fairly high on that unit. And usually, a lot of the data shows as far as horn length goes for a score and otherwise, a three-year-old can be just as good as a five-year-old or a six-year-old or so on and so forth. So pronghorn don't tend to, you know, get a lot bigger with age.
After a certain point, they are what they are.
Yeah.
Okay.
So as long as you got three-plus years old bucks out there, you're in pretty good shape for that number of tags that we're putting out there. And we should have good reproduction from here on, barring a really tough winter like we had 2 years ago.
If I'm not mistaken, I think that Parker was one decimal of being at the bucks per 100 does it's supposed to be at.
Yeah.
I think it was supposed to be at 40, and I think it was 39.9 or supposed to be 45, and it's 44.9 but
right.
For 100 does.
Ernie.
Jump shift, a new topic. I was really impressed in multiple rack minutes on some of the discussions on wildlife management and biology that occurred in this round of meetings. And you just commented on that a couple of minutes ago. Some great discussions. I thought they were educated and mature and a lot less of the emotion and so forth that you frequently hear in RAC meetings. But beyond that, there were some really great discussions on crowding and the social aspects of big game hunting and on management of our hunts. And I really enjoyed your comment. I may have been both the central and the southern, but I think it was the southern primarily. You kind of made a statement to the effect that you're just seeing the type of the iceberg. You're now approaching the beginning of the problem that the northern region has lived with for decades. And that immediately made me think back to our alternative hunt schedule discussions and the proposal that the division developed to try and combat some of that overcrowding problem and quality of the hunt. Could you talk for just a minute about issues of overcrowding and social problems in hunts and how that alternative schedule relates?
Sure. You know, as you all know, we presented this to this board we presented it a long time ago, this new hunt structure that splits the general season into an early and late season. And we presented it again to this board recently as kind of, do we want to pursue it or not? And I think we were given the direction to just kind of hold on and see how this plays out. And obviously, you know, when you talk crowding, it's more of a perception issue than a reality issue. I mean, there was a time we had 200,000 deer hunters in the state, you know, that was probably crowded. Now we have, you know, less than 100,000 and then still perceived as crowded. It just depends what people, you know, perceive as being crowded. I mean, if we ever get to the point where that is the main driver of, you know, the people's satisfaction is how crowded they are, we certainly could go to that split season and do that. And that would be a way still have the same number of permits, but reduce the crowding issues.
John.
Anise, quite a bit of discussion at the different racks. Some voted to go with the Yuba proposal to keep sure. to keep the splits
mm-hmm.
the way they are. Is there any, coming from the division, I mean, is there any real heartburn if we did that? I mean, personally, with me, it makes sense if we're going to move rifle hunts around to address crowding issues. I don't know why it would be, and I understand it falls within the splits, but it still makes sense from the way I look at it not to take primitive weapon tags and put those back into the rifle.
Yeah.
And I just, would it be that big of a deal if we just left those splits the way they are?
It wouldn't be a big deal biologically. It just goes against what's in the plan. And once, you know, because, you know, when you take all or when you take that and make it into the split 50, a lot more are going into the primitive weapons, and you have two rifle hunts that may all both have high success rates. I don't know how it'll play out. I guess either way, we're going to harvest the animals. It's just it'd probably be a little bit less harvest, which I don't know how that will play out as far as we need the harvest there. So if we keep it at 50%, it probably isn't going to change from what it has been in the past. So either way, I don't think it would be a big deal. We might want to consider, you know, when we redo the plan, to modify it somewhat when you get to a certain high percentage in that late hunt, maybe keep it at 50, 30, 20, just so we're...
Maybe have it as another option instead of just automatically switching it over.
Yeah, and again, that's kind of, you know, we try to recommend everything towards the... Unless there's mitigating factors, which I don't think there is in this instance, try to stick to the plan whenever possible. And, you know, it wouldn't be that big of a deal.
Not a big deviation from the plan.
I was going to hold this off till tomorrow, but I'm going to get it out in the open today so you guys can think about it. I was the member that sat on that statewide committee for elk 3 years ago. And, Anise, you can correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm not going to mention names, okay? There was some discussion in those meetings at that time that dealt with the units that we're kind of talking about today, that somebody made a proposal that if they upped the age class on those like 1 year and then give more archery or less success hunts on those units at that time during those meetings. And that was rejected by some of the people that were there who actually said, we would rather have 3 to 4 year old units and 5 to 6 year old units than we would have the upper end. So what I'm saying is these people that are wanting to switch that, at that time made the choice that they wanted small age class units, which they got, and now they're coming back and wanting to redo how we hunt on those units again.
I'm not following you, Jake.
So, in other words, some of the people wanted a higher age class on the units,
mm-hmm.
and the archery community did not. So they settled on what was accepted in the plan. So now they're coming back 3 years later and wanting to switch and get more archery tags on that unit and less than what was decided during that time.
Are they wanting more archery tags, or are we just wanting to keep the archery tags we have?
All I'm saying is there was a chance in those meetings to have it the way it is that they're talking about today, and they didn't want it at that time.
Oh, okay. I got you.
Anise,
I'm fairly correct there, Anise.
I mean, it was a trade-off. You know, there's always more people wanting the rifle tag. So if you know, when you put 30% archery and 20% muzzle loader, there's going to be fewer rifle hunters that are going to draw those permits, obviously. So, and that's where the most of our hunter pool is rifle hunters. So it just makes it tougher to draw those units that have a lot of elk. That should be a little easier to draw in, with a rifle. So, but it's a social trade-off. It's not a biological one, but it's one we did discuss at the meeting. So,
if you just take the numbers, going back to the 50-30-20 and the 60-25-15.
Mm-hmm.
If you got 100 animals or 100 permits, and so you go from 50 to 60, you got 10 more rifles out there that's going to have 50-60% success, so you're taking half a dozen animals.
Sure. Yeah.
That's about what you're doing.
Right. Yeah, and these are units where we want to harvest more animals, so it's not, you know, having them in the rifle doesn't hurt anything, and taking them out is going to save a few animals. That we'll probably add permits next year to try to harvest. So, you know, either way, you'll come out. It comes out in the wash, I guess. So,
but they are in areas that you do need to harvest some animals.
Yeah, so the Wasatch specifically.
It does help with your numbers.
Yeah,
to bring
the Wasatch
those
and the Deep
down.
Creeks are ones. And Nebo is pretty close to being where it needs to be, so that one is neither here nor there. But the Wasatch and the Deep Creeks are both above their objectives.
So we do need to harvest some animals, and that's one way to help.
Right.
Facilitate that.
Yeah. And really, number permits can be adjusted to deal with that in the future, so it's not that big of an issue. I think success rates will be about the same.
We're only talking literally, if you scrub the numbers, you're only talking about a few dead elk one way or the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Does it help more with the overcrowding when you have the split that?
For sure.
It moves a lot of them later.
Yeah, and that's the main reason we did this, is we were getting to a pretty good number of permits on these units.
So it just helps so not everybody goes out the first weekend.
Sure.
Sorry, Ernie, I keep cutting you off.
Nope. Go ahead.
I'm going to ask you again about this. I'm still getting asked about the late hunt on the Wasatch. Do we have any tooth data from the last late hunt we had, when we decided to do away with it because we were getting into the older age class?
You know, that was so few permits back then that I don't know if I trust the age data. I think this hunt will tell the tale of what's really being harvested. They weren't any older than they were in the regular hunt. I don't have that data. And I don't want to say that it was exactly the same or older or younger.
Because there's a lot of people in the valley there, specifically that live right along the front there, that watch those elk. And especially if you get a little snow with that many tags, you could really put a hurting on the big bulls.
Yeah.
And that's obviously a concern. So, yeah. And I guess we talked a little bit about our RAG meeting about keeping the age data, you know, for that hunt so that we could look at it. And I'm not sure, you know, how we combine that or whatnot.
We could certainly split it out after the fact and see what effect it's had. I don't anticipate it will be higher than in the rut, just because.
I don't anticipate the success being any different because we plan on everybody, pretty much everybody there, but the age class, you know, are we getting into just the older bulls, or is it spread out like we're hoping?
Sure.
So.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see. I think when you have, like, I think it was 10 or 15 permits when we had it before.
We had 40.
Yeah, in the late hunt?
Yeah.
Yeah, there was one year we had, like, only 10 or 15.
Yeah, there were several years it was pretty low.
Yeah. So anyway, I think, you tend to do that. But when you have lots of permits, animals are being moved around, people aren't as choosy, especially if you're waiting in, you know, snow or whatever. I think we'll just have to wait and see. I can't predict. I doubt the laws of averages always seem to be on, you know, on our side, and it ends up being about, you know, this.
So if it averages out about the same as the early hunt, then we haven't harvested heavy into the older bulls or the younger bulls.
And if we see that, we can also
adjust the permits or whatever.
Percentages between early and late. You know, that's the nice thing about the way we do our statewide plans. It gives us that flexibility to manage, you know, proactively and not having to, you know, we can always change percentages as far as what, how many go in the late versus the early, if that's the case.
Another elk question I had on the Monroe. It's been brought up, I've had several guys mention it to me. They're really concerned about the number of spikes that are surviving on the Monroe.
Yeah.
And that we're harvesting big bulls at a rate that our spike recruitment can't sustain.
Yeah.
Can you
address that? I actually made a handout of this, and I was going to ask Vance to help me with it because he's a biologist and he happens to be here. But I'll hand this down.
Way to go, John Bear. We're going to wait until the end to discuss that.
Yeah. We can wait till the end as long as we bring it up.
Talk about it sooner or later.
I tried to protect you, Vance, until the crowd was gone.
We just want to get this out of the way. The sooner you're done with the fight, the sooner you heal up.
You bet. Maybe just speak generally, and then I'll have Vance get into the details.
Is Teresa here, too?
Teresa.
Oh, there she is, Mike. All right. I just didn't want to feed Vance to the wolves all by himself.
Yeah.
So
the Monroe is kind of a tricky one because we count a winter population, but the summer population looks a lot different than the winter population. So we can't really make assumptions about the numbers of animals based on a winter count. And that's why I put this together to kind of look at the complex of units that feed the Monroe in the summer, as well as maybe give you a scenario of what it looks like. And maybe, I don't know, if Vance can kind of go through it and explain a lot
sure,
of that.
Sure, you bet. So this year we did our helicopter census of these four units that you see listed there. These are the units that have the big interchange of elk. And this is the first year that we've done them all together. Took about 8-9 days of flying with two choppers, and it was you know, we suspected this was the case, but it was really eye opening, and we got the proof this year. And so, as a complex, we estimated the population at 10,600, which is just right close to the 10,400 of our objective. So, as far as that goes, we're just sitting right where we want to be. But if we look at the population estimates, Monroe with an objective of 18, we only estimated 1,400. So Monroe, we're always chronically below objective, and the reason is you just look down there at Mount Dutton, and that's where those elk are going during the winter. Our collar study, we've had a really good collar study going for 3 years now. And it shows that approximately a quarter to maybe a third of the elk that winter on Mount Dutton go back in summer on Monroe. And so even though our winter estimate was 1,400 for the population on the winter based on the count, if you look down there, 2012 Monroe summer count or summer estimation, we're probably closer to 2,500 animals that are summering on Monroe. And so when a hunter or a person looks and sees that, gosh, last year we harvested 165 spikes out of only 1,400 elk, that doesn't make sense. And it doesn't make sense. And so we have to be able to look at the whole broad picture of things. And what we've done on this this paper here is shown an example. If we look on the 2012 complex of units, you go off onto to the far right there, you see the projected 2013% yearlings harvested is only about 35%. And that's based on, you know, last year's spike harvest, population estimate, and the number of calves that were born the previous year, which is quite low. Quite low, and most of that is probably due to the Fish Lake elk herd, where we've really seen a shift of hunters not hunting the Fish Lake, going to Monroe, the Pavant, or other nearby units. So we have a really high spike survival rate on the Fish Lake. And if we went the projected 2013% of yearlings harvested, 97%, you know, if we based it on the 1,400 winter count.
We'd be out of business.
Be out of business. And so we know it's just not right. And so
that's actually counted, I know, more than that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know,
yeah.
So it's, when you look at it at that unit level, it's not a picture of what's really happening, because those animals are just there in the winter.
Yeah, and so keep in mind, though, that the Monroe is a unique mountain. We have a little bit harder time keeping our buck-doe ratio up there because of the access reasons, a little bit easier to hunt. And same thing on the spike hunt, I believe. I think we do take a higher percentage of the spikes when you compare it to the Pavant or the Fish Lake. Are we in dire straits and in an emergency, you know, with the percentage of spikes harvested? I don't think so. We have reduced the number of big bull tags there significantly compared to, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. And that was in first and foremost because we raised the population objective to 7.5, 8 years old. And
the age class objective.
Yeah, the age
right.
class objective. And previous to that, we'd been raising the bull tags in order to meet that the previous 5-6 year objective. And so once we raised that age objective, we had to start cutting tags to make sure we could meet that. And in the anticipation of the spike hunt, removing some spikes off the mountain. But definitely, as was brought up, there is people are concerned about the spike hunt and how many spikes are being taken. That's definitely, you know, some talk in the community about that. And I think we need to take that in consideration. But are we in dire straits? I don't think so.
Put a number on this. Based on your summer estimate of the population, which is both based on your winter actual counts and some of that collar movement data that we saw, GPS collar data?
Correct.
Based on that population of 2,500, how many spikes would you ideally want to remove to meet the spike hunting plan for a bull population that's more than adequate at the objective?
You know, I think that's really hard to say. There's plenty of bulls to do the breeding. It really depends on what your outcome, what you want at the end.
The outcome would be the age objective.
We figured a lot of our calculations figure on about 60% of the spikes being harvested. So this is still below what you could harvest and maintain the age classes you need. Again, on this sheet, we went really on the conservative side. We said we only have 25 bulls per 100 cows, which we know is higher than that. So we did worst case scenario when we put this together, so it wouldn't look like we're, you know, padding it.
Huh?
Yeah. So I think you could harvest up to 60% of the spikes on a given unit and still maintain a high age class of bulls in the older age classes.
Would that say that 304 number is the number that would correspond or something close to it?
Yeah, something close.
That's not the estimate of the number of spikes. That's the estimate of the harvest.
No, that's the number of spikes that are available for harvest.
Oh, okay. That is the
spike. Then the number harvested is 165. Is on the column right next to it.
So we're harvesting 54%, which you're
right.
saying is well within
right.
reason.
Exactly.
That's on the assumption that your summer herd is what you say it is.
Well, that's based on, yeah, the best data we have on what our summer
And you've
population.
Got collared elk that we've watched and moved, and
mm-hmm.
and you have a pretty good...
Yeah. Again, I'm saying this is conservatively, and I believe that summer population is actually higher than 2,500, because it almost has to be able to harvest the number of animals that we're harvesting. It's just, you couldn't harvest that many animals if you had fewer. It's just, you know.
Chairman, I got a couple questions, if I might. Vance?
Yes?
You've already answered some of these, but I'm going to have you re-answer them, okay? We went from a 5- and 6-year-old unit 3 years ago approximately to a 7-8 year old unit today, correct?
Correct.
when the manure unit was a 5 to 6 year old unit, we were producing probably over 100 big bull tags. Is that also correct?
We were giving out for a time. We were issuing a little more than 100 tags for a time when we were trying to reduce that the number of large bulls on
the way I remember it, we were giving out between 80 to 130, I think, was on the high end.
Correct.
Okay, so if the average of that somewhere around 100.
Right.
Okay. If we were still at a 5 to 6 year old unit on the Monroe, would we have enough recruitment to hit 80 to 130 tags?
That's hard to answer, but probably not with the spike hunt. I don't think we could be issuing that many permits.
I don't think you could issue them even without the spike hunt with the age objective you have there. To maintain that size of age class, every year you bump up, you lose about 25% of the tags. So it's a pretty substantial. So if you're managing for a 7.5 to 8 year old bull,
getting back to what I was saying is before we hunted spikes there, it was a 5 to 6 year old bull unit,
right?
And we would produce 80 to 130 tags.
Correct.
My question was, would we do that today, hunting spikes?
Yeah, if you put the age objective back to 5.5 to 6,
I don't think you would.
I think you would.
6.5 today, and you're down to 29 tags.
Yeah, but that has little to do with the spike hunt and more to do with the age objective. The spike hunt hasn't even been in place 3 years now, so none of those spikes would have even been old enough to be harvested yet under any scenario.
Okay, so if you look at your branch antlered coming in, you got 20 of them.
Again, that's not a real number. That's just what was counted. Those are animals.
Well, those other animals are counted somewhere else, aren't they?
Exactly. I mean, you have on the whole complex roughly 1,500 bulls. That's the number of bulls in the population.
I understand that.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is there comes a time in September when all those animals doesn't stay there.
Right.
As soon as the archery people come, they dismiss and go their different direction. Them spikes do not.
Correct.
And in my mind, in all the people's mind that live on that mountain, and Vance lives there more than anybody, we're killing too many spikes. And that herd will not grow to the point where it was before if we don't change not the full amount of spikes, but maybe as many as we kill. And I'm not against killing spikes on there, but I don't think we can turn 3 hunts on there with... Anyway, I think there's different ways to hunt. Vance, do you have any other ideas how we could hunt that hunt?
As far as hunt spikes?
Yeah.
And not
harvest. It would give us a lower success rate, maybe?
There's a few ways you could lower success rates. Season length reduction. I don't think we've ever done that on a spike hunt, but season length reduction may be a tool, primitive weapon use, different things like that could be options, possible options if you want to reduce the percentage that were killed.
What about something like archery and muzzleloader only on that unit?
That would definitely decrease the number of spikes harvested.
I hate putting you on the spot, but what's a true number in your mind of spikes that you think ought to be killed on that unit? To have that growth that you need to come
right
back in.
Yeah, that's really subjective because that's, asking just my opinion on what it should be. But
no pressure.
Yeah.
No pressure.
Yeah. If we were to reduce the number of spikes killed by, 20%, or so, I would feel comfortable I think we have enough bulls now, but if the public wanted to see more big bulls up there, then you could reduce them. But I really can't tell you the number. So
let me follow up on that comment. If we reduce the number of spikes by 20%, aren't we going to end up where we were 12 years ago with a mass surplus of bulls in the herd, bulls dying of old age in decrepit condition, and less available opportunity for our hunters?
I don't think you would be in that position, but you're right. You know, in the 10 years ago or so, we had a real excess of bulls on the Monroe, and that's why I think we had 120 tags, so many tags, because we were trying to bring the number of bulls down. 20% is probably, it wouldn't put us in that category of all of a sudden we have too many bulls or anything.
30 bulls a year for 10 years is 300 bulls.
That's assuming they all live that long.
Yeah.
You're still going to harvest, a certain section of those bulls,
Ernie,
every
look
year.
Look across the highway at the fish lake, and you're shooting 146 off there that has different terrain than what the Monroe has. And you're shooting 165 out of what an East calls 2,500, and we got 5,100 across the road.
Now, the harvest on the fish lake historically has been a lot higher. It's been around 300.
250 to 300 spikes.
So it just dropped off for hunters are not hunting there as much.
Yeah, they're going
to,
like I said, when we opened up these other units.
Yeah, so.
You know.
So there were higher harvests on the fish lake in the past, up to 300 or more spikes being harvested, which is double of kind
of. I had in my book the first year, and I called on this, and I should have wrote down where I got the information from, but I didn't. But the first year the Monroe opened, I had written down that we killed 212 spikes there and 205 on the fish lake.
Yeah, it would have been.
I think I got that information from you guys when we did the wildlife plan at Springville.
I think that the spike cars we've had it for 4 years now has ranged from 99 to last year's high of 165. So it's bounced around in there. That number probably included the number of large bulls that were harvested, and that might have been where that number came from.
Let me ask the question a slightly different way. When we initiated the spike hunt in combination with the age objectives of the bulls for the units, the goal was to try to maximize opportunity while also meeting the age objectives on the units in the long-term run, and to minimize or optimize the number of old bulls that dry in the mountain, not affording opportunity. Would you change the numbers that you're recommending right now in order to get closer to that stated objective?
Not necessarily. I think what it comes down to for me is issuing 25 permits on Monroe Mountain for any bulls. Is that what the public wants, and is that adequate? And so if we wanted to reduce the number of spikes, we could probably increase the number of tags, maybe not by a lot, but somewhat, and whether that's what the public wants, I don't know. I do know that the spike hunt's very popular on Monroe. Over 800 hunters hunted it last year. And so if we close the spike hunt, those hunters would go somewhere else. So I'm not a real big fan of completely closing it.
I can see what Ernie's saying. Hmm? I mean, we don't want to go back to the days of a huge surplus of bulls. If we reduce the number of spikes being harvested by a certain percentage, there's still many more spikes being harvested now, even with a slight reduction, than there was in those days when we had a huge surplus of bulls. So I guess what we're all kind of fishing for is what's the happy medium? How many spikes can we take and still have a healthier big bull population without going back to those days and without eliminating the spike cut.
Yeah, I mean, if you cut, just to throw out a number, if you cut your spike harvest in half on Monroe, that would be pushing, you know, a significant number of spikes into the big bull population and maybe lessen concerns of over-harvesting the spikes. But whether it's needed or not is a value judgment. Yeah,
I think people are basing all of this on current number of bulls on the mountain when the spike hunt hasn't even started to affect the number of big bulls on the mountain. So they haven't seen those build. The reason there's fewer big bulls on the mountain now is what we hunted them hard for a long time.
The reason we have fewer tags now is because we had to push that,
exactly,
that big bull population, yep, down.
80, 100 permits for multiple years in a row. We killed a lot of big bulls on that mountain. Now we're in a rebuild mode. We have to start.
It's because of the age objective increase.
Right, being raised, right. Yeah. Okay. So I think and it's human nature. People are don't want to wait and see. They think if we get rid of the spike count right now, those spikes are not going to be 7-8 year old bulls for another 7-8 years. So you could eliminate it right now, and you're not going to build anything for 7-8 years. And then you're back in the mode of killing spikes so you don't. So, you know, we need to be thinking ahead. If you're recruiting 100 bulls into the population, and we're, right now our estimates is we're recruiting 140 spikes into the older age class. We're only harvesting 25. So you're actually, you're recruiting, by the time they get to be 7 years old, more than enough. And then you got to think, if you're averaging a 7 or an 8 year old bulls, there's 3 or 4 years before and 3 or 4 years after of bulls that are in that population as well. So that's a lot of elk. It's not a small number.
So how do you come up with 140 spikes?
That's the number. If based on 2,500 animals on the mountain, if you harvest 165, there's 140 left. That's the number that, you know, you can't really argue with because it's on paper. It's what's produced. These are the number of animals that realistically have to live on the mountain for us to be able to harvest.
And again, keep in mind that some of them are beginning in August, are moving around.
Moving around, but big bulls are always going to follow the cows. And if you have X number of cows on the Monroe during the summer, during the rut, you're going to have big bulls there as well. Some do start moving off around that time, but I don't think they all leave the unit. So,
but if we wanted to get back to the days when we... I mean, Utah's, the way it's set up, we're for limited entry elk. And the spike elk was secondary to help control what Ernie's talked about. But if we wanted to get the 80 bulls on that unit for limited entry...
You mean 80 permits?
80 permits. 80 to 100 permits, whatever. Could you do it with what you have there today?
I think you could if you lowered the objective on the ages. You cannot do it with this objective. Oh. No, you cannot, because the objective is meant to have more big bulls in the population, so you harvest fewer. So if you want to harvest an 8-year-old bull, you have to harvest very few bull, probably 5 to 7% of the bull population to achieve that level of age, and you just can't do it with this age objective. Whether you harvest spikes or whether you didn't, because you're recruiting plenty of spikes.
But your age objective right now is only half a year over what it used to be.
It's a big difference. Because we're trying to build them back up to 7.5. It takes
and
a
I
lot.
I understand that. What I'm saying though years. Is what the average age on there is right now is 6.6.
Right.
And it was 5 to 6 before, so it's only a half a year over.
Yeah, but we're building, so it's going to take a while to get
that.
And then I believe once you get to that, if we get to the 7.5 or 8 year old bull, and then you're building more bulls on top of it, you will eventually start to increase permits at some point. We just haven't gotten there yet because we were in the mode of reducing objectives for a long, reducing the age in the harvest. It's you know, it's one of those things where we changed direction midstream. We were harvesting a lot of big bulls, and now, you know, we want to harvest fewer so we can grow more big bulls.
We can get the big bulls
back.
Yeah,
exactly. And that's going to take some time. I mean, obviously people are harvesting the biggest bulls on the mountain all the time. And
to get to that objective, yeah. A good percentage of those have to survive right. through the hunt.
Yeah.
Anish, you said earlier that if you increase the age objective by 1 year, you can figure that's a 25% reduction in permits.
Roughly, yeah.
And we went with a 2 year change right. on the Monroe. So that would be a 50% reduction ballpark right. figure.
Once you reach the.
I should be around 60.
50 to 60 instead. Yeah, but you're rebuilding at this point, trying to get up to that new objective. It's not a stable.
Right.
Juanice, let me try to understand what you just said. And that is that I don't have an objection with what you've said.
Sure.
But I'm just trying to long term, because I think that's where we're headed. If we continue on this track that we're on right now for, let's say, the next 4 to 5 years, 4 to 5 years from now, we should have more big bulls on that herd and still be taken at 40% spikes. Isn't that not right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Hey.
Because all of spikes we've harvested so far would only be 3 years old right now.
Sure. I understand it. They're not contributing to the take.
Exactly.
As mature bulls.
And, I'm curious to see, we went from 6 year average last year or 2 years ago to 6.6 this year. I think next year's harvest could be quite telling, if we still see that increasing trend in our age objective or average age of harvest, that would be quite telling next year's, or this coming year's harvest.
What really concerns me about that unit is we've cut the permits back so much that sometimes when you have such few permits, it doesn't, represent the population, so the harvest isn't really saying. Usually you have to have higher number of permits to represent.
All of a sample size, is that what you're saying?
So I would hope we wouldn't get below 25 or 30 permits, so we can still. We got in that trap on that unit in the past where we kept reducing permits, so we would never get to the objective. And it was because we didn't have enough permits to really represent the population. So
let me ask you this question then. Based on what I just said and what you've said 5-6 years ago, Utah was killing as many 400-point bulls as anybody. And excuse me for using that term, but that's what reality was.
No, it's true.
And now that has disappeared. But if, based on what you're saying and what I'm trying to understand, I think that could come back in a few years.
I think it could, too, because we're starting to manage some of those top end units for that. In the past, we weren't. We just happened to be, blessed with the surplus because we were harvesting at a low level anyway. But when we started ramping up harvest because those objectives were lower, we were biting into that top end. But now we've set aside those 6 units that we said we're going to manage for that 400 inch bull, and once we start building back up, I think we will be there again. Again, it's not going to be statewide because we do have some units where
it's
we're managing from
5.5 to 6.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's tough for me and everybody else to wait that, 4 to 5 years to build bulls again, but I think we will see it.
Do you see a time when we'll have limited numbers of any, just limited in any way, shape, or form, spikes rather than just statewide, we got X amount and go where you want?
We certainly could do that even now if we thought it was needed on specific units. But, I don't see why not. It's certainly an option. It just makes it, that much more cumbersome to have the basically limited entry spike tags for each unit and all that. right now it's easy and people can do it. And really, overall statewide, success rate's like 16%. So it's not like we're killing the guts out of them.
But. And let me just switch gears again. Let me go to the Booklifts, which is our country, you know.
Right.
And our people out there feel same as the Richfield people do.
Yeah.
But the same thing could be happening there.
Correct. And actually, the Booklifts are doing fairly well as far as maintaining their age classes. And I think as we build, we will, you know, see more bulls in that older age class. The nice thing about elk is they are long-lived. So they live, you know, most bulls will live to be 15 or so. And that's what keeps you building bulls, even if you have only, you know, 40 to 50% of the spikes making it into the next age class.
Any other comments for Anise? Ernie wants the last word.
Well, I've got a different one. I'd appreciate Anise sitting there, if he would. If you could pass the... I said earlier that I was really delighted at some of the conversations that I read about in the RAC minutes, and I was. They were really superb, talking, you know, wildlife management and buck and bull management and population management. And then there were also multiple discussions in the RACs that really bothered me. One example was a discussion of, God, we're not at an elk objective yet. How can we possibly consider increasing the number of antlerless permits? And it made me start looking at other comments in some of the RAC meetings and other advocacy positions that were taken. And then I started thinking back to the arguments that I was hearing 15 years ago. Here they are again. It's sort of like a Medusa. You cut the head off with one group, and 3 years later we got new people sitting in the meeting, and here it comes again. And then I thought about how many hours of time over the last 15 years I've sat listening to these discussions, and how do we put some of these things to bed, and why haven't we? And came to the thought, well, maybe we're just not educating our conservation groups, our sportsmen, as well as we could be. So I came up with this rapidly put together idea of how do we elevate some of the discussions at our RAC and board meetings and from our sportsmen. And I don't think the specifics of what I've got listed there as potential topics are very important, because around to do the voting. Basic idea is, how about we develop a list of topics that the board says we need to educate our sportsmen on a little bit better. Something like the basics on elk populations. Why, when you're at 4,800 elk and you've got an objective of 5,000, do you need to harvest 800 or whatever it is, antlerless elk? And why are we required to not overshoot objectives by the state? And a few things like this, and put together either a little PowerPoint or a SFW and RMEF and Mule Deer Foundation to get this out to their members, so we don't go to another RAC meeting and hear somebody saying, wait a minute, we're still 200 animals below objective. We need to go easy on this. We need to slow down. And any logical projection would say we need to take 1,000 elk this year. Way over objective. Also, maybe just the basic concept of our problem is not growing elk herds in Utah. Problem is how do we control the numbers, and especially when you start talking private land units. Another example was a discussion in the northern region saying, God, we didn't have 100% tooth sample. So we went in and we took all the people that didn't submit teeth this year, and those are the people that harvested a bad bull, by the way, if you didn't know it.
More truth to that than you're willing to admit, though, aren't you?
Yeah. So at any rate, I did a little more looking, and there's actually a lot of backup on the tooth data. First off, there's just basic statistics. And once you get a sample size of 70% or something, that's huge. It's absolutely over the top. And that's what the division has got. And then beyond that, you also have harvest reports that come in independently. The harvest data from those that submitted a tooth and those same thing, that's substantiating maybe the data that you've got and reinforcing that you've got good information. But here we've got people that are challenging the number of tests that are being issued because we don't have 100% sample. And there's reasons why getting 100% sample with big penalties might turn around and bite us all in the bottom too. So there's another idea, an area where perhaps we could do some education. Sportsmen coming in and challenging the permit numbers like happens every year just because they haven't got enough data and education probably out there and available. So the thought is, how about we ask the division to give the board a list of topics that might fall into this kind of a category. The board could review them. Then the division could put together some education material. The board could yay or nay vote out what the division comes up with. And they go out as board, I don't know what you want to call them, position papers or statesman's papers, and send them out to the conservation organizations and ask for their help in getting this information out. Like it, maybe we could do an action item tomorrow.
Well, I'll say it doesn't hurt to put anything on the action log. Doesn't mean that they're all going to come to fruition, but it says establishes a point in time where we've asked somebody to think it through and give us some kind of report. I do concur with you, Ernie, that I'm not sure the sportsmen understand the whole biology that Anise, you and your people and the regional biologists are going through. And I thank you a bunch for what you do do. You take it on the chin more than anybody in this DWR because of that, but you do a wonderful job, and the men behind you do a good job. And I understand what you're coming with. I'm an impatient soul as a rule, you know, and I think there's about 50,000 others out there that like to shoot that are impatient too. And that's part of the problem. But thank you. So I don't want to put any undue burden on you, but I do concur with the idea of educating the groups and the sportsmen as much as possible, because I don't think they really have the understanding that you do.
And I agree with that. I think education is a part that we fall short on a lot, and I think we could do more. And I would be glad to take it on if you know, it's not something I shy away from.
Well, I think it would be beneficial even for members on the board.
Sure. Yeah.
I'm not sure we understand all of the nuts and bolts of the modeling processes and the types of data that you use to plug into those models. And the more we understand that, the better off we are, the better able to make decisions, because we know where you're coming from as well.
Yeah.
Bill?
Yeah, I support the idea, too. I think education, including us, would be very beneficial. And, you know, since I've been on the RAC and then later on the board, I don't know that I've ever seen a plan that's been accepted ever make it to the end of the plan without being altered and changed multiple times, and oftentimes because of perceived anecdotal information that may not have anything to do with reality. I remember the first board meeting I ever came to, sitting out in the audience, listening to one of the biologists make this long, detailed presentation showing the statistics of, about a particular elk unit. And then one of the board members said, well, my uncle was there last season and he didn't see anything. And in his mind, everything that had just been explained was at rubbish and not, you know, to be believed. So I think the more we can educate ourselves and our sportsmen's groups, you know, we can only help ourselves, I think. So I'd be very supportive of this idea.
John.
I appreciate Ernie's handout here. But as I sit here and think about this discussion, I can't think of anything that we're going to talk about today that I haven't, and I've been going to RAC meetings since 98. Every discussion at a Bucks and Bulls or a antlerless meeting from 98 to now, I don't see how we're not going to have it again for the next 10 or 12 years or 15 years. And that's part of the process. People come to the meeting, they ask questions to the biologist. I've been on the phone over this exact stuff, questioning numbers on the Wasatch with Covey a dozen times in the last month. And I would like to think I have a fairly good grasp on how it works and on why we increase permits when we're close, why we harvest. But I don't know that it's as simple as, well, we're gonna put this out there and educate everybody, and that's gonna solve our questions. I mean, you put the facts out there. How many times do we put the facts out there on everything? On conservation permits, on how many teeth do we need to cut, on hunter surveys. We go over these facts every single year, and I don't see, no matter what we put out there, I don't see how that's ever going to change. That's part of the process, discussing it, asking questions, and educating people every year.
Yeah. And I agree with you. I think it is still going to come up. But I think what Ernie's trying to get to is there's a lot of details we can't get to in a RAC meeting just because it's you know, so contracted. It's a small process. So
and I'm not saying I'm opposed to it at all. I think it's a great idea.
Right.
I don't know that there's a silver bullet.
No, there isn't. But I think we can do better, at maybe educating the public and getting information out.
You can only get so many people educated, even if you present the facts. You have people that will learn, people that will understand. You have people that maybe already know, and you'll have people that will ignore what you say, regardless of what it is you're trying to to put across.
Right.
But I think the more of that middle group that you can affect and help to understand the process, the better off you're going to be. You're going to be ahead of the game. I mean, from an educational institution, that's kind of what we hope to do, is to raise the level of knowledge a little bit and understanding. But I admit, you're probably going to have these kind of questions always.
Director Sheehan, do you have a comment?
Just a comment. I haven't seen the handout, but I heard a few of the things you mentioned that are on it. And, you know, and if Anise is interested and feels like he's got time to put something together, I think that would be fine. I think we could send it to the sportsmen's groups, and I'm sure they'd be glad to forward it. But as a couple of you mentioned, you know, it might capture a snapshot of time on some of these concepts, and then all of a sudden we're dealing with the Wasatch elk again or Monroe or units that we'll be talking about 2 or 3 years from now that aren't issues or problems right now. So some of it is just sort of an ongoing thing. But, you know, I think if you look at some of our management plans, those are already out there now, and they all start off with a pretty good background, you know, trying to give a little bit of information about these things, but maybe not tooth data or some of those sorts of things. So if Anise has some good ideas, maybe he could bounce them off you, Ernie, to see if it captures your thoughts. That would be fine. But I suspect we'd put some effort in. We'd send it out. A few people would read it. Some would get it. Some wouldn't. And it would just sort of be a thing that we did one time. I don't know if you'd do this every year or how you kind of keep that, or if it's just some information that you've captured for a moment in time with a group of people that may be part of it. But anyway, those are my thoughts. But if that's where the board wants to go, it sounds like Anise would have some interest, I think, could put something together.
Yeah, one of the other examples that is three-point buck hunting. I think we could probably get a unanimous vote on the board that we don't support three-point buck hunting for the three-point or better for the following reasons. And I've probably answered five of those comments, and Anise has probably answered 500. Well, if we had a wildlife board adopted position and education paper on three-point buck hunting, might be real easy just to attach that to a thank you very much for your input. Here's the position of the Wildlife Board.
But certainly you're right about one thing. We, when you both mentioned, you know, a 15-year span of time, you got people that are moving into this as an interest and people moving out, and you're always going to have that educational curve, the new, you know, 28-year-old who's got it all figured out, who's never been to a meeting and just knows that DWR has got it wrong. And, you know, we'll educate those folks as they come along. And it's still, we'll all still get phone calls forever from some of those folks. So.
Okay. Any other questions for Anise? We've captured you for quite a while.
Oh, that's fine. There was, John had a question on the Wasatch, and I think Kobe put a presentation together on that, and if you wouldn't mind, I think
there's quite some concern on the Wasatch, so if Covey can educate me so that I don't have to ask these questions again, that would be great.
Assuming you're going to
pay attention, John.
What is the concern, John, if you could?
The concern on the Wasatch is the cow tags, especially around the Wasatch front side and the south end. Arguably, the elk are not as visible as they have been years past, and thus bringing up the concern that there's not as many cows there as there should be. And also, the concern is that the south end of the unit's taking a beating to keep the unit as a whole in under objective, because we can't kill elk on the north end of the unit, which is private ground, which is without a doubt a problem to kill elk on. People on the south are feeling abused, while the people on the north won't let people in to kill the elk, but they don't want the elk. We're over objective, and it's a problem. And granted, it's a tough unit to manage. It's got some unique problems, and Kobe's going to solve them all for us right now, I'm sure.
I'm going to solve them as soon as I can get this my flashlight.
Kobe, can you get the mic?
Yeah. Okay, so what I did is I went back 5 years and looked at the flight data. So I guess that's one of the first things we need to go over, is that these are geo-referenced points on a map. Is that working? Geo-reference points on a map, and then this data here that's laid out on this map. Another important point is that this data was taken at the end of January for all of these. So this is after a lot of the winter migration has happened, and a lot of these cow hunts, we try to, some of the subunits, we try to catch that migration. Some years we're better at it than we are in others, but keep that in mind as we go about it. The two units that were in of particular concern here are the southern units, like John mentioned.
Kobe, can I clarify one thing, too, before you get going here? One thing that too, I've asked Kobe to get this information is because in our RAC meeting, when they were asked to approve numbers on the cow tags on the south end of the unit, and were asked, well, how many elk are there, how many did you count, and that, they didn't have the answer on that. So this
got
is kind of clarifying. You got it today. So this is kind of clarifying that. So we know if we approve X amount of cow tags, how many cows were actually counted in those subunits.
Yeah, yes. So, again, the south end of the unit there, The Diamond Fork and Springville units were the two that were of concern. I think the thing that's not of concern here is that the population objective is 2,600, and this is 08 data. We were well over that then, and we're well over that now. So in 08, we allocated 400 tags to the Wasatch West permits. And the Wasatch West permits, that is over the whole unit, and that cow hunt overlaps the spike hunt. And on that, we had about 43% success. That 400 tags, that made up 33% of the total number of tags. That same year in 08, we allocated 200 tags to Diamond Fork, or 199 tags to Diamond Fork, and 200 tags to Springville. So that was 34% of the tags went to the southern area, and the other 33% went to the north, went to the northern unit. So if you draw the line right above the Springville unit, half the tags went north, half the tags went south. That's pretty consistent with what we're seeing in our counts and our numbers. In 08, there were over 900 elk found in the Springville and Diamond Fork units, 950 elk somewhere in that area.
Is that actual counted elk? Is that actual counted elk, or is that your sightability?
The 934 is counted. That number is counted. The numbers on here are estimates. So after, based on counts. So they're not modeled estimates. They're estimates based on counts.
That's cows, right?
I should mention that the points on the map before we go on, I want to mention that for sure. I took all the bulls out, so this is just cows that we're seeing represented here. And obviously there's no sightability factor on the map. It's just they were there, they weren't.
Background, could you talk about general access? Could you talk a little bit about the general access in those areas?
Yeah, and I've got a slide at the end that shows land ownership.
You got it.
Okay. Okay, so this is 2011. It should be mentioned again that 2008 and 2011 were both closed winters or heavy winters. Again, the south end there, it's hard to see a lot of the boxes overlay, but there were some big groups of elk out on the Maple Face and up Hobble Creek. And we know that those elk come down from Strawberry and around. There's some old collar data that shows that migration, and migrate through a lot of the Diamond Fork unit. So this year, in 2011, they increased cow permits on the overall unit. 600 of those went into the Wasatch West permits, which, again, overlaps the spike hunt. It allows to hunt everywhere on the unit, on 17A. The Diamond Fork and Springville units then each got 11% of the remaining tags. The Springville hunt success was 46% overall, a little bit better than the success on the Wasatch West. The concern is that the Diamond Fork tags success was low, less than 10% success. They only killed 12 cows that year up Diamond Fork. Again, it's a migration issue, and we probably need to work harder in the future to line that up and hunt it in a way that we hit it. It's not an issue where we've killed all the cows off that end of the mountain. I'm still about half the total number of cows, close to half the total number of cows, are, if you draw the line right above the Springville unit, about half the elk are below that line and about half the elk are above that line.
So was that an access issue for that low success rate on that Diamond Fork area?
There was also access issues that year as well. The Forest Service did lock up the gates. And so any of the elk that were up higher were completely inaccessible. And that's, when you're along the Wasatch Front, that's always an issue. The gates getting locked and late cow hunts sometimes don't go very well together.
Why do they lock the gates? I know that, and maybe you don't know that. Obviously, that's a Forest Service.
It's forest policy. I mean, it's to prevent degradation of the landscape, I guess, in the winter. They feel like they'll have issues or have had issues in the past, and they lock the Wasatch up.
That keeps the people out, keeps the animals there, so there's more animals, and they degrade the resource faster than if the people were there.
Just they have to plow the roads and all that if they kept them open, and it's liability issues. I mean, that's what we hear from them anyway. It's just
okay.
And we've worked with the forest on this issue. I should mention that in more recent years, we actually got them to put in more gates and close down and open up as instead of just closing it at the
instead
bottom.
A gate at the bottom. Put a gate halfway up and let there be access further up.
So we're trying to work through some of these issues. We're not just...
Okay.
If those elk aren't still, for one reason or another, like up on the top of Maple or way up on Cascade or something like that, and it's hard to get to them, are you considering that an access issue where you got to walk for 2.5 hours to see them?
It depends on how much snow there is and how much somebody's willing to put into that. Yeah.
So do you consider that an access issue, or is it just hard to get to issue?
Both. I mean, it's how much work is a hunter willing to put in for a cow, I guess, would be the question. The ones up there on Maple, they're accessible. Do you want to pack one down that? I guess would be.
Yeah, and just to put things in perspective a little bit, our cow hunt successes range from 20 to 70, and on average they're about 40-42%. So that the Springville hunt is right within what most of our other statewide cow hunts, and the one on Diamond Fork is on
pretty low, but not pretty low, but not because of lack of animals, but due to where they're at,
exactly
where their migration route runs, and lack of access.
And we know that cows don't tend to winter up Diamond in that area. We know that they move around to the face. At least they have done that. That's been the trend. So it's they're moving through. They might rut there and then move on through. Okay, so this is last January's data. Again, about half the population is below that north-south line. Half is above. But when we flew it, this was a very open winter. And still not a lot of cows in the Diamond Fork unit, but there are a lot of elk below that line. On the hunt again this year, we don't know what's going to happen. We recommended that 22% of the tags, or 11% for Diamond Fork and 11% for Springville, go below that north-south line. And then with 46% of the tags being able to hunt the whole unit, and then the other percentage... hunting north of there. This is just a 5-year summary. I included before on the maps just the... So this is the 5-year summary of the Diamond Fork early hunt. You see there, we have had years where we've had better success, but we have also had years where we've had that same success. 2009 was low success, whereas 2010 we had, 50% success on that. So if they're there, you get them. If they're not, you don't. But the percentage of tags that we're allocating to that is 11% of the total number of tags. It's not like we've gone crazy and allocated all the tags to the southern. The perception that we're allocating a higher percentage of tags to the southern area is not. It's just not true. And this is the 5-year summary on the late hunt. Again, decent success, except for the last 2 years, they haven't been in there.
Just a question on your satisfaction index there. How many points is that based on, and when do you collect that data?
It's 5. It's based on a scale of 5, and we collect it post season when we do when we collect the rest of the data.
It's part of the harvest survey, so after the harvest. And it's basically, it correlates really well with actual harvest. So those that harvested have good satisfaction, and those that didn't, don't. So when your harvest is high, you have good satisfaction most times. I mean, sometimes it does vary. Like you see, they had 60% success and almost 4% satisfaction. 4% satisfaction is good. So yeah, I mean, that one, there's rare occasions where nobody harvests and satisfaction is high, but that's not
usually the case.
I got another question for you. Kind of a general elk question, I guess, that might pertain to this. I know, guys, I have very good friends that have planes that fly that. They say we don't see the elk that we used to see in this area, in this area. And I was a kid growing up where we used to see elk, now we don't. Where we never saw elk, now we sometimes you do. Could some of this, and I'm asking your professional opinion, how often do these elk change their, just their habits? The old cow that used to take them there got shot or died, and so they decide to go somewhere else for the winter or the summer. And I mean, how much of this could it be that they're just moving to another place? And yeah, we're not seeing them in Diamond Fork. Doesn't mean they're not there. They're just somewhere else.
Yeah. So
is that possible? I mean, is that part of the case?
Not only is it possible, but that's exactly what happens, especially with elk. Elk are not as traditional on their ranges as mule deer are. They're really susceptible to pressure, human pressure, hunting pressure. If you've hunted them on the forest as well, they're the furthest away from a road that you can possibly be. Usually is where most of the elk end up being, and that's you can move elk from unit to unit across units very easily with hunting and with just, you know, human pressure. So yeah, they're not as they seem to be not as traditional in their use habits. They'll move. They're a little more traditional on the summer range, as long as they're not bugged. They will a lot of times calve in the same areas, but even then, if you put a road through there, they're going to move. So they're really susceptible to human interactions. They want to avoid people as much as possible. So yeah, they can be moved easily, and we see that all over the place in the whole state. We hunt them hard here. We have a bunch of elk show up. You know, now we have too many here. We hunt them here, so we're moving.
Really not a big deal for an elk. I mean, in 10 minutes, they can be over the mountain in the next drainage gone.
So get up and go and move 20 miles just because.
I mean, and as a specific example to this, we thought we were doing a better job at getting back to objective on this unit until Randall Thacker flew Current Creek and said, thanks, you pushed them all over into my unit. So yeah, he was way, way above objective because of pressure on 17A. So they'll move.
Anise, what you were just saying about the pressure, I imagine that's still true even with non-hunting pressure, like through ATVs and mountain bikers and all the land use patterns of people out there recreating in various ways.
That certainly affects them. Obviously, it doesn't. Obviously, nothing affects them more than seeing their cohorts being killed. But yeah, that pressure does affect them, but not as, when you're hunting them, they know death and they know how to avoid it.
Can I ask you guys tomorrow as we're going through this, can we include that bit of info into the, I mean, I've heard you talk about it a little bit before, but as we talk about some of these areas that are really easy to see these elk up Diamond Fork where there's a lot of people and stuff. I mean, that's an important part of the discussion to know that pressure, they're not all dead.
Right.
They move.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And so I just have a couple more slides here. So this is the 5-year history of Springville. It's more consistent, but as we see, those elk are there in the winter. And if they don't catch them on the earlier hunts, they catch them. They have more opportunity to catch them there. They stay there. They're on those faces. It's not just winter migration. And this is a Springville late. Last year, they had really good success on this. So I overlaid all 3 years' counts, and then it's really hard to see, but I also overlaid the land ownership here as well. Green being the forest, and then you can see the green line where it ends. That's private up there at the East Heber area. There's a lot of private there, and we're working through access to a lot of that. Some of it we have access to, and some of it we're still working through that. But again, a lot of these elk Some are on private, some are, and a lot are still on the forest. And then I just showed that migration route from Strawberry on there as well. Okay, so to close, I just want to remind you that the pressure is really not uneven. It's only 11% of the total allocated tags going to the Diamond Fork and 11% going to Springville, with 32% going to the north end of the unit and 46% can hunt anywhere. So, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, can I just say on the record, I appreciate Kobe and Anise digging this up and bringing this information. That answered a lot of questions and helped me out immensely. So thank you very much.
Thank you, man. Next on our agenda, definition of youth, Judy.
Good afternoon, Judy Totoro, Licensing Coordinator of the Salt Lake Office, and I'm here to talk about an action log item that Ernie asked me to work on. And what we did is we put a committee together, and the whole the committee was Anise and Blair Stringham, Jason Robinson, Kevin Bunnell, Stacy, Martin Bushman, Greg Hansen, Amy Canning, and myself. We met a couple of times and went through as you can see on this handout that I've passed you all out, a lot of our rules and seeing how we had the definition of youth kind of strung out at all different ages. And that was the whole concern to, you know, to look at that and see what we could do to make that better. So what we've come up with is that any person age 17 years of age or younger on July 31st would qualify for as a youth. And we're not tweaking with the statute or any of those ages to hunt. We're talking about additional opportunity to be able to do something. And so this date was chose because there's no big game or small game hunts happening at that time period. The definition would apply for all youth opportunities for big and small game. And any youth opportunity that is offered in the future, we would follow this definition. We have several rules affected there. And if you guys feel comfortable about this definition, we'll take it out through the RAC process and get it approved and start, you know, using it in our guidebooks and our processes. So. Yeah, pretty straightforward. We're kind of excited about it. It's been difficult to track all of these different ages for youth. So that's my presentation.
Any questions from the board?
What is the definition of a youth now? And I guess that's the problem.
It depends
on the hunt.
What you're talking. Turkey, big game, small game, what you're talking.
Because it all is what your age is when the hunt begins. And so it's all over the board.
It's all over the board.
You could be a youth in one hunt, but not a youth in another hunt. And this just standardizes. It puts a date certain. It draws a line in the sand. If you're under 17 as of this date, you're a youth, regardless.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay.
Yep, so.
What's the current age now for a fishing license? Is it 14?
There's a 12 and 13-year-old one for $5.
Oh, okay.
An adult one is 14.
So this wouldn't have any impact on that?
Nothing to do with any kind of those concepts. Nope, they stay in place.
Any other questions?
I guess this would... Sorry, Mr. Chairman. For our deer hunts, our general season deer hunts, to hunt all three, this is the definition we're going by when we approve it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. 17 and under, yep.
Excellent.
Bigger, yep. Small our, game.
Excellent.
Our contractor would love
approve.
Us.
It is excellent. Thank you.
Okay, great.
Turn 18 then on August 1st, you're still a youth, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh.
But if you turn 18 on July 30th, then you're an adult.
Yep. Just follow.
Automatically that. Qualify as a.
Yep. That's
full-fledged adult.
All right.
Okay.
Okay. Great.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'd like to compliment Judy. That is the simplest, easiest presentation on a big game topic I've ever seen made.
And it's very needed. That's something that's going to make
Dell
our
and Ernie,
job better.
As you leave the board, you can say you did simplify something before you left. Can't take that away from you now. It's solid.
Thank you.
I'm fine, unless you don't want me down here.
Okay. Next, preference point, Lindy Varney.
Hi, I'm Lindy Varney, Wildlife Licensing Specialist. I'm going to talk about our preference point system. This presentation is an action log item regarding our preference point system relative to the new 30-unit DARE plan. At the next board work session on May 29th, we will have our 2013 data to compare with our 2012 regarding how applicants actually applied in these units. So here's a little history of our preference points. The preference point system works the best when there's I've had issues with this all day. Sufficient permits to allow all applicants to be successful every few years. The point system began in 2000, where you only earned a point if you were unsuccessful in the draw. We did change this in 2009, where you earned a preference point if you were unsuccessful for your first choice only. So we only award preference points to individuals that are unsuccessful in the drawing for the first choice only, or if they just purchased the point. This is a graph illustrating how many remaining permits we've had from the draw that are left over. As you can see, in 2006, we had a little over 26,000 permits that are remaining from the draw. In 2009, you can definitely see that it dropped down to around 8,600, and that's when we made the change. So it definitely relieved the pressure from our over-the-sales counter sales day, and people started actually putting in multiple choices. Instead of just putting their first choice, they started putting 2 through 5, and that was the purpose of the change in 2009. So this is how our general season draw order works. The first thing they evaluate is the lifetime license permits. Once those go through, they look at our dedicated hunter applications, then our youth 18 and under applications. Once all three of those are evaluated, it looks at the rest of the applications that are in the draw. Change it, it would be 17 and under. So this chart is to illustrate how our drawing sequence works. So let's say right now 4 points is the max point for a certain unit, for the general season. It looks at a certain person at their first choice, then their second choice, third choice, fourth choice, then their fifth choice. And then it'll go back to the person that has 4 points and looks at all 5 of their choices to see if they can get a permit. Once all the people with 4 points are looked at, it will drop down to the next category of 3 points and do the same through until they get to all the applications. So now that I've explained how our draw works, I kind of wanted to give you some statistics that we do have for our 2012 general season. Last year, we did have 100,854 total applications that went through for the general season buck deer hunt. Out of that, 65,653 actually drew their first choice. And then from there, around 4,500 drew their second choice. Around 1,700 drew their third choice, 889 drew their fourth choice, and 484 drew their fifth choice. Now, there were people that were unsuccessful in the draw, and as you can see, 25,970 did not draw a permit last year. And then there was around 1,700 people that were ineligible, And the reason why is because they drew another buck deer permit either through their limited entry application or their dedicated hunter application. And so it made them ineligible for the general season. And here's some additional information. Out of that 100,000 applications, a total of around 7,500 applicants earned a preference point that drew with their second through fifth choice. And out of that 7,500, only 1,334 applicants actually had 1 point or more. And then there was only a total of 8,275 people that purchased a preference point. So they didn't put in, they just bought a point.
Can I ask a question that will seem very naive and maybe informed on my point or part? I stopped hunting when I moved to Tennessee, and they told me that I was going to have to pay to get on a landowner's property to hunt. So I haven't hunted for lots of years and have really not paid much attention to preference points.
Mm-hmm.
How does one purchase a preference point?
It's just through our application. We give them the option of just buying the point, or they can apply for a unit. So it's just a little button that they push during our application period that we have for the month of February. And then usually we extend it for a couple of weeks afterwards where they can just buy a point. So they're not applying for any hunt unit.
And what do they pay for a point?
It's the $10 application fee.
$10.
Yep. So, yeah, those, 8,000 people just bought the $10 point. So that's kind of how our system works. Some information on 2012. Stacy has put some data that we have for 2012 in your Dropbox about their applications and the success rate for last year for the first and second choice. And I put on all 90 units on there so we can look at different weapon types. So if you do have any questions, I love to explain it to you.
No. Any questions from the board?
Let me go back and try and the reason this got brought up was because we had multiple cases identified last year where a person applied for a hunt and was unsuccessful when another person had applied for that same hunt as his sixth choice or something and got that hunt that the other person wanted as his first choice,
mm-hmm.
and the person that got the hunt also got another preference point, so now he'd have two preference points the next year.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a number of inputs that said, hey, something's wrong here. Why does this other person get a preference point and the hunt that I wanted his first choice when it was his sixth choice? And so that was the question of fairness that brought this action log item up.
Yeah.
Could you go to that? Well, now let's go down here and flip down one more, please. Last year was the first time that we drew under the 30-unit deer hunt system. So there may well be some anomalies in the system that are going to resolve themselves quickly.
Correct.
And that's why Lindy's saying we're going to come back to you today with the second year of data to see if things continue.
Yeah, so we can see if there's a trend or if things changed.
Ernie, you're going to have to explain that to me again. Make sure I follow you. What you said, six choice,
well,
four
I wasn't
choice.
Going to correct him, but there's only five choices.
Ernie knew what he was talking about.
This one?
Nope. There, right there.
Art?
Okay. In the bonus point system, the way that if you had four bonus points, if you had four bonus points,
mm-hmm.
then they would look at your first choice.
So you look at the first choice first.
And if you didn't draw that, it'd be the end for you for right now. And then they'd go down to the people with three bonus points, and that person would then get their choice on the first. So forth. In other words, those lines that now go to the side would be going vertically.
Mm-hmm.
And preference points, if you have one preference point, you can pick out five hunts, and you will get your... If you get it before anybody gets with no points.
Yeah, okay, I'm with you. I know what you're talking about.
And if you didn't get your first choice, let's say you got your second choice, you get another preference point. So a person could, now let's go back to the beautiful. So now a person could hypothetically put in for the plateau 25 there, and the odds of drawing out on the plateau last year, 2012, were 1 in 26. If that continued, I don't think if it did, that means the next 25 years I could put in for the plateau as my number one choice, say Zion. For number two choice, I could draw out the Zion for the next 25 years. Still keep building.
I know what you're saying. I believe that's how Colorado does it right now. I mean, this is the same process as Colorado. I put in for the high country buck hunt I want every year and don't get it, but I can get my second or third choice every year and still build a preference point.
Yeah, it's the same.
Yeah.
Okay. So
okay.
Now, as opposed to what you could do in the bonus point, where you could have been close to doing that. Now, let's go back to the drawing thing again. So the question here may be more one of, is this process where a person can get their sixth choice,
which is
still one of the best hunts in the state, and get another preference point? Is that better? Or is the process that we're using in the bonus point system a better one, fairer to more individuals?
We're talking strictly general season deer.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's the question of what's good for our citizens, what's fair.
And the reason we're having this discussion today is we had this discussion last November, somewhere there. And we said this could be true. We could be creating some patterns we're not comfortable with, but we don't know that because we'd done 1 year's data. So it was moved to an action item for today. So you're getting a good overview today, and then next month we'll actually have 2 years. So we can kind of go down and see how many people that did this happen with what sort of patterns. So the bigger discussion is it isn't hard to drop that thing that says you don't earn a point if you're in your second, third, fourth, fifth, but will we excuse me, get back into a pattern of not selling archery units on the whatever because nobody wants to, you know, they'd rather wait and try to buy that over the counter, and are we just going to push a bunch of permits back over because we got people trying to build points? We don't want to drive people back to big sales days because not much good ever happens when we have lots of people on big sales days. So hopefully we'll have a little more info as soon as we conduct the draw here shortly.
But the other option, and Greg's absolutely correct, going back to having 25,000 tags sold at the regional offices is not something I'd want to see again.
As long as they're at the Salt Lake office only.
We're good.
Oh, well, we'd love that one.
But the other option
that has issues.
The other option is just change the drawing sequence. For example, draw the 4-point preference point holder's first choice first. And if he is unsuccessful at that, then instead of going to his second choice, you go down to the 3-point preference point holders and draw their perhaps a guy with a 3-point preference gets his first choice instead of a 4-point holder getting it as his fifth choice.
I kind of talked to our contractor about that today. I talked to Ernie a little bit earlier. And so I called them, and I kind of got some pros and cons of what that would bring up if we did go down to, 4 points, 3 points. More people would draw out their first choice with 0 points than they do right now if we did do that. But then again, if we did that, you're not doing a preference. You're just doing a preference of their first choice. So each individual that
we're not giving them. Okay, I see what you're saying.
We're not giving them the preference of their choice. The next thing would be, retraining, telling people that, hey, we're not doing the point system anymore. If you draw out any choice, you're done. You're not going to get a point. And like you said, they're going to go back over to over-the-counter. And as you can see, we've had issues before in the past with our internet or crowding, and people don't like to come in and buy it over-the-counter.
Except the guy could still get...
Could
still get his preference point if he didn't draw his first choice.
Yes, that is true.
So he'd be guaranteed virtually of getting it the next year unless it's a plateau unit.
Unless it's plateau. And like I said, it may change this year because, who knows what people are going to do, and that's why we want to do the 2 years worth of data.
Let me just... talk out loud as I understand it. I got 4 preference points. I go clear to my fifth choice and I draw it. And I gain a point. So next year I got 5. I'm still on top of the stack. And as long as I draw anything but my first, I'm going to have a really good chance of drawing every year. And everybody below me's got a poorer chance of drawing every year.
That is true, but sooner or later you're going to draw on your first choice.
Yeah.
And then,
it's not, going to go on forever.
So, no, it can't go on forever because sooner or later you will draw out that first choice.
Most of our units are, I don't have the exact number, but, 3 or 4 points are pretty much getting you there on about anything. I'm not even sure you need
I looked 4. This morning, it's about 1 to 2 points.
Yeah, I mean, there might be a couple of units
you need. That's for rifle.
Yeah, by the way, I just an aside here, but it's too humorous not to pass on. What would you like to guess are the maximum number of preference points that some people hold? And the answer is, how about there's a number of them with 13 preference points?
Preference points?
General.
Well, I guess I don't want to go.
And I'm going to turn it over to Lindy or Kenny to tell you the story of how this was all discovered.
Well,
there's 5 non-residents that have 13, and it's just because they thought they were limited entry points.
Well,
confusion.
Good for them.
Confusion there.
Yeah. They fixed stupid. That ain't our fault.
it's an interesting discussion for sure, and with only 1 data point, even 2 doesn't really constitute any kind of trend yet. 3 kind of gets you there, but 2 will give us a little more information. The most telling side for me, the one I think Lindy did a good job of preparing, was that last additional information slide. And that second bullet there in the middle, we know 1,000 of those guys could have gotten over on the system, but it's 1% of the total number of applicants. So it wasn't a big significant impact on, what we were trying to do. It's just 1,000 of them. And like we just talked about, time will catch up to them. They're going to be successful on their first choice likely next year. So that will be an interesting one for me to flesh out in the next month or so to see where it ends up. But then, it's a pretty insignificant number who actually could have gamed the system. So to
Lindy, go back one slide. Mm-hmm. I think that's the one where you show the successful applicants. So yeah, 65,600 hunters drew their first choice and are out of the preference point business. So that's a pretty significant number of people that got their first choice. So I just want to point that out.
84,000.
Ernie, as we go through this now, I remember having this discussion, and I remember this being brought up at the RAC meeting as well, where it came from. And as I think about it, it's a little bit funny that some of the guys that brought this up don't like this here. Brag about going to Colorado every year where this is how it is. I mean, you can draw your first choice, or you can draw your second choice or your third choice and still get a preference point every year. So I have to be honest with you, I don't have any heartburn with it either way. If we decide it's a problem at some point and want to fix it, so be it the way it is. It's all right. I mean, if you build a couple points, like we said, time is eventually gonna get you. In a year or two, you're gonna draw your first choice, and you're gonna be out of it. So, I don't know if it's worth it getting all worked up over.
I think one thing too to keep in mind, because we're striving for consistency, is on preference points, they are attached to antlerless and swan, and we have several other species. And if you start changing that plan, think of all those drawings.
This is how it is for all of them right now.
Cow elk.
Yeah.
This is our preference point system as we're looking at it right now across the board.
You bet. Yeah.
See, and that's something else I hadn't thought about.
What was that?
No, that's bonus points. Yeah.
I'm not claiming that I know the answer to this one. Yeah. I sure want to see this 2013 data before we make any
decisions. We worry about it.
But
it's
a really complex little subject. So I'm delighted the division presented it today to prepare us for the votes we have to take in May.
I don't think that the 99% of our public really knows how any of this stuff works, you know. I think they kind of get the preference, which is if you have more points, you're probably going to draw, and they kind of get the bonus point thing, but I don't know if everybody really gets this or not. So
and I remember talking about it last year.
I'm with you, Greg. Any other questions?
Thank you.
If not, thank you, Larry.
I was curious to ask. Yeah. On the limited elk, do you have one in there that shows when I'll ever draw one of those? Will that happen?
I can look.
Okay.
Stacy, can we get that info that she presented sent to our Dropbox?
The PowerPoint?
Yeah, the PowerPoint. Please.
Go and take
thank you.
Minutes.
Do we get extra preference points for being on the board? Is there anything like, can you earn a preference point, or do you have to just buy it and get one a year?
After you retire.
Because that don't really seem fair.
That's after the licensing chief gets his goat permit this time.
Yeah, let's see how that goes.
Thank you.
Don, you get extra emails and extra phone calls. That's what you get.
I get everything else extra. I just want to get some extra points out of the deal.
I'm sure there are people out there listening to this that would agree with you, John.
I'm sure there's many that are surprised that's not the case.
Let's see, it's just 3 o'clock. Let's take a quick 10-minute break, and I say quick. If anybody wants a break, we'll be back here at 10 after. I want to move right along once we get back from break. Thank you.
Well,
okay, if we can, let's get started. Our next item of business is use of scopes on muzzleloaders, use of crossbow during any weapon hunt season. Tony Wood from law enforcement. Tony?
Good afternoon. I'm here to talk to you a little bit about scoping muzzleloaders and crossbows and their application or potential application to Utah's any weapon hunts. And probably to start out, we probably ought to review where we are currently. At this point, for those of you that aren't aware, Utah regulations limit a legal muzzleloader to utilize in open sights, peep sights, non-magnifying one-power sights. Legal archery equipment is defined as essentially not being a crossbow. So currently, any sort of magnifying sight, any sort of a crossbow is disallowed from use here in the state of Utah during their respective seasons, as well as on the any weapon hunt. There is one caveat there. Rule 657.12 allows for disabled accommodation. And this is specifically for those individuals that have some sort of a physical impairment that disallows them from drawing back a traditional vertical bow, or someone that may have a degradation to their eyesight that precludes them from using a non-magnifying sight. When I was first asked to take a look at this, I was kind of interested. I heard the discussion earlier in regard to the three-point or better. Kind of my version of a three-point or better issue is, why can't we utilize magnifying sights on muzzleloaders during the any weapon hunt? If I had a dollar for every time I've had that discussion through my years in law enforcement, I probably could have retired by now. It's a question that we receive frequently. It's a question that we receive oftentimes in the days leading up to the hunts in the fall. And unfortunately, it's a question that we also have to answer pretty frequently when someone has gone out, thought they had done everything correctly and by the books. They have taken a once-in-a-lifetime animal, for example, and only to find out that they had chosen to take it with a muzzleloader with a magnifying sight, and then subsequently learned that that weapon was, by definition, an illegal firearm, and putting that trophy animal in jeopardy. And unfortunately, that happens a couple times a year. And so this was really an opportunity for me to take a look at where we're at with other states and how we stack up as far as consistency goes, and see if we're out of line or where we currently stand. That interest and that excitement of being able to take a look at this particular issue waned a little bit when I started looking at the information that was provided to me by Gary Cook and Anise. Because what I found very quickly is it's very difficult to compare apples to apples when we're talking about hunts and hunt structures. And you might ask a question as to whether or not an individual can use a magnifying sight on a muzzleloader hunt, only to find out that they might be able to use it on a muzzleloader hunt in Arizona, but that state may also potentially have a primitive weapon hunt where they would be precluded. So it's very difficult to compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges, and I hope that this will make this or this presentation will make that clear to you as well. Currently, this is a map showing the status of Western states and how those states approach their muzzleloader hunts and whether or not they allow for magnifying sights. You'll see that use is allowed in eight of those states. Three of those states, like ours, allow magnifying sights with restrictions, or allow an optical device with restrictions. And in this case, we're talking about our disabled accommodation, or our COR process. There are also seven states that strictly restrict usage of magnifying sights on muzzleloaders. One thing that was interesting to me was the state of Utah, of the three states that allow optical sights, particularly here, a magnifying sight with a COR, we are the only state that actually allows an individual that has some sort of sight impairment to obtain a COR for a magnifying sight. The other states, I'm speaking specifically about California and Idaho, have got a COR process, but their COR process only grants that individual the ability, or a permitting process, only allows that individual the ability to utilize a one-power non-magnifying sight. So those processes in those two other states actually bring them in line with where we start at the ground level with our muzzleloader hunts. The next map here shows crossbow status. And here I'm speaking specifically to whether or not a state allows the usage of a crossbow during that state's established archery hunt. You'll see that five of the states do allow crossbows, and they do define those as being any legal weapon or a legal weapon for usage during their respective archery hunts. 10 states, like the state of Utah, allow for an individual to obtain a permit. A COR due to some sort of a physical impairment, and to utilize that crossbow during the archery hunt. And then there are three states where it's strictly disallowed. Just as a matter of interest, Kenny just pointed out to me that the state of Utah issues, correct me if I'm wrong, is it 400? Roughly 400 CORs to individuals to utilize crossbows in the state annually, and on a big year, as many as 20 CORs are granted to utilize a magnifying sight on a weapon that would be otherwise prohibited. So that's gives you an idea of the numbers of requests that we're currently dealing with here in the state for those individuals that do meet the definition and the standards of physical impairment that we've put out there.
Just pointing out one thing, a lot of the states that do allow it during the archery hunt have lots of whitetails in the states as well, so it kind of muddles it a little bit.
And a question on this slide right here. Wyoming would be the only big mule deer state shown on this slide. And if I remember right, they do not have any data that shows hunter success or anything else.
Yeah, none of the states I talked to had data specific to success rates on crossbows. And the reason they gave me is that there are so few people that actually use them, and not only use them, but are successful to harvest, that their sample size is just never big enough to tease it out. So even though not a lot of people hunt with them, or not a lot of people are successful when they do hunt with them. So the data they have just doesn't say one way or the other whether success is higher or not.
Denise? So then flipping the other direction, we're getting a lot of information on wounding mortality and hunter success and all that, but that information then is coming from whitetail states.
Yeah.
Anise, with the information that you just gave us prior, was that from Wyoming or was that from all the states?
Which information?
Where they weren't getting enough information on muzzle.
All states I asked, okay. None of them had information on success rates and wounding loss for crossbow specifically.
Specifically in dealing with mule deer.
Right.
Not trying to jump ahead. Do you have a slide that shows what states allowed on any weapon hunts?
I do. Yep. We're getting there. And here we are.
Okay.
So you can begin to see here where we begin to separate ourselves a little bit from the rest of the crowd. Of the western states that we surveyed, three states currently disallow the usage of a crossbow on an any weapon hunt. 15 states do currently allow their usage. And then the next step forward is magnifying sights on muzzleloaders and their application to any weapon hunts. And we stand alone at this point. So we've set ourselves aside a little bit, and I hate to admit it, I did feel a little good about this because I'd always scratch my head a little bit when members of the public, when hunters had questioned me as to why do we do this. I've struggled. In doing research online, it seems to me that there's traditionally been a couple different reasons that have been thrown out there. One of them is that a magnifying sight on a muzzleloader may encourage an individual to stretch the range or to take shots that they otherwise would not if they could actually see the animal in a magnifying sight. But in my experience in law enforcement, what we find time and again is that when you try to legislate common sense, you tend to get yourself into trouble and step on toes that otherwise shouldn't be stepped on. In addition to that, I think that it's a bit of a struggle for me. An individual with a 300 Winchester Magnum and a scope is in all likelihood just as apt to try to stretch his own personal limitations as well as the limitations of his particular tool. And so it is what it is. Again, what I found was trying to compare apples to apples with being very difficult. What I found was that there are nearly as many approaches to this particular issue as there are states out there. One state in particular, Arizona, issues crossbow permits that are consistent with our current disabled accommodation CORs. They carte blanche allow the ability to utilize scopes on muzzleloaders on both their muzzleloader hunts as well as there are any weapon hunts. They take it a little bit further. If you take a look at this graph, this was ripped directly from their proclamation, and they actually allow, and I don't know how else to refer to it other than maybe as an intermediate range weapons type hunt, where on their muzzleloader hunt, they actually allow the usage of crossbows as well as archery equipment. And I'm not saying that that is an approach that we should take here in the state of Utah, but it does at least give you an idea of the range of variation in approaches here when you talk about weapon types and the various hunts that are out there. One other issue of interest is the far right column there where it references pre-charged pneumatics, 35 caliber and larger. I don't know that I've seen that previously in other states. It is a first for me. So.
I'll be the guy who says, all right, what is that? Everyone else.
It's a pellet gun on steroids, I believe.
I told you. It's an air gun.
There you go. So,
if it's got to be larger than the 35 caliber.
35 caliber, yeah.
Do they make a lot of 35 caliber air guns? Does it just roll out the end?
You'd think the deer would see it coming, wouldn't you? I can't speak to it. I've never seen one myself. So, just a few observations. Where crossbow usage is allowed out here in the Intermountain West during archery hunts, it's typically because there's some sort of a physical limitation which preclude the individual's ability to draw a traditional vertical bow. Several states, as I had mentioned earlier, have established primitive weapon seasons. So they may have a primitive weapon season, a muzzleloader season, and an any weapon season. And if that's the situation, typically the primitive weapon season has much the standard that we do, whereas their, for lack of a better term, modern muzzleloading season allows optical sights. And lastly, though it's difficult to compare across the board here, it's pretty clear to me the state of Utah is in the minority in dealing with weapons types and their application to our current any weapon hunts that are out there. So what I'd like to suggest, and what I think is a measured approach here, is that we consider liberalizing our current definition of any legal weapon to allow for scoped muzzleloaders, to allow the usage of crossbows during our current any weapons hunts. That brings us much more in line and what makes us much more consistent and, frankly, competitive with our neighboring states. I'm not asking that we... or wouldn't suggest that we consider looking at liberalizing our archery hunts or liberalizing our muzzleloader hunts that are out there right now. But it seems like to me like this is a measured approach to the question that we get time and again. And frankly, it allows us as law enforcement officers to deal with those individuals out there that may choose to utilize a muzzleloader, and quite frequently it is on a limited or a once-in-a-lifetime bull moose hunt, allows them to utilize that muzzleloader, put a scope on it, and do it legally. So, the next step, if that were to be considered further, is that we would want to look at each of the individual rules that could be potentially touched here, and we're talking about big game, upland game, waterfowl, cougars, fur bear. We occasionally get requests from bow fishermen to utilize crossbows to take carp. There are several options that are out here that I think would bring us more in line with some of our neighboring states, and frankly wouldn't cause or present a significant a threat to our existing resource. And then the last is. We recognize muzzleloaders with magnifying sights as legal weapons for usage during our any weapon big game hunts. Just some additional considerations. This is largely going to be a social issue that's going to play out in the public process. I fully anticipate that there would be some vocal resistance. Traditionally, we have seen some of the more traditional archers, traditional muzzleloading groups resist this this issue, and I would expect that may continue to be the case. I may be wrong there. Again, as Anise had alluded to, there's very little research available in regard to these proposed changes, specifically when we're talking about mule deer here in the western states. And it's also a bit of an unknown whether this would actually increase overall participation in our various hunts, but it certainly would increase recreational opportunities for those folks that had an interest in pursuing them. And that's all I have for you this afternoon. Happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Tony.
Will we be able to measure increased participation at all? Is there a methodology where we can figure out if the option's being taken?
Yeah, we certainly could add it into our surveys. What weapon type did you use on the any weapon season? And then that would get you to success rates as well.
For those that have surveys, some of these don't.
Yeah, for the big game, we certainly could.
Because you got carp and turkey and upland and some of those that we don't survey a lot of those.
All the complaints that we've really gotten have had to do with the big game area. Would get some feedback. Second question, are there any Hunter Orange implications here?
You know, I would, and this is just off the cuff, if this was an any weapon hunt, I would have to say that they would be expected to obey the Hunter Orange requirements.
Where in both cases they don't have to now.
That's correct.
Both archery and muzzleloader.
That's correct. And again, it would just be for those individuals participating in the any weapon hunt.
I'm sorry. Will you go back to your last slide? The very last bullet there talks about increasing recreational opportunities for some. And I know when we first started to talk about this last fall, whenever it was, one of the questions that came up was what would happen if we started to see an increase in success with these, in particular, muzzleloaders, as far as being able to harvest an animal. Would that have an impact on the overall number of permits that would be available then in future years in the regular rifle seasons and so on? Can you talk about how you looked at that, or if you did look at that?
I think Anise can speak to the permit issue. The one thing I would like to say and to keep in mind here is we're talking about individuals with scoped muzzleloaders hunting alongside individuals with scoped centerfire rifles. I don't see this as being or representing a potentially significant increase in success rates because they are going to continue to participate in those any weapon hunts as opposed to using a scoped muzzleloader on the muzzleloading hunt.
So I guess that brings up another question. I'm not quite clear on that. Are you suggesting that you allow only scoped muzzleloaders during any weapons hunts and not during primitive weapons hunts?
Yeah, correct.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah, the recommendation or the suggestion is to only allow it during the any weapon season, not during the muzzleloader and during the archery season.
Okay, and so what? I mean, that was one of the issues that came up to begin with, was allowing that during the muzzle loading.
Yeah, so we're not, I guess we wouldn't recommend going that far, because then basically it becomes almost another rifle season if that's, you know, the case. It's not really very much a primitive hunt anymore, so unless we want to add a primitive muzzleloader season, which complicates things, we suggest just allowing those that want to hunt with a rifled a scoped muzzleloader to hunt during any weapon season, and then the muzzleloader season would stay the same as it is currently.
And how does that compare with other states?
Yeah, I think Tony showed some. It's fairly similar.
I can take you back here. Nearly every state, 17 of the 18 states that we looked at currently allow scoped muzzleloaders on the on their any weapon hunts. If you take it back a step further, these are the states, those that are in blue, five states currently allow scoped muzzleloaders on their muzzleloading hunts. So it would actually keep us right in the ballpark.
I think with Colorado and this new gun laws, why they're going to allow crossbows next year.
I'm sorry?
I think with new Colorado's new gun laws that crossbows might come up being okay in Colorado next year. Nobody else can have any guns, so.
As long as it's not a 30-round magazine attached to the crossbow, they're fine.
Okay, so I guess that leads to my last
question.
I got
a question then. Have we really accomplished what the people who wanted these scopes put on their guns by just going any weapon?
I think that I field a significant number of questions from individuals that have drawn specifically once-in-a-lifetime hunts, and they want to be able to take that moose or they with a scoped muzzleloader. I think that we are meeting the needs of the majority of those individuals that have those questions, and we're doing it in a way that's not going to substantially, from my perspective, understanding that there's very little data out there, significantly increase success rates on our populations.
Do you think we'd see a huge impact on deer and elk taken if we were to allow it out, like during the muzzleloader hunt?
You know what? I don't think on general season deer, you probably will not see you may see a slight increase because currently they're almost identical. Muzzleloader success is almost identical to rifle success. So would it increase more? May or may not. Where you're going to get pushback is not on the biological side of it, it's on the social side of it. They're the traditional muzzleloader guys don't want guys out there with muzzleloaders with scopes, and similarly the archery guys don't want so it's more of a social issue, I think, than a biological issue. I don't think
maybe see the case on the archery side because you know it's maybe not quite as difficult, but you got to sneak up within so many yards or whatever to get
it. Yeah.
To me, I think, especially on the crossbow side, I think it would add so much more opportunity and recreation for, like Bill and I.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not going to walk 2 miles off into the forest, but at the same time, you know, I think there's an older generation that would maybe enjoy that.
Yeah. Sure. And
50 yards where we parked the car.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, I guess, but the reason a lot of these other states don't have it is because there's opposition to it by the groups that are, you know, traditional archers or traditional muzzleloaders. So we certainly could bring it up, but I would think we would get opposition again.
Well, the same argument can be made for telescopic sights on a muzzleloader.
Right.
And that's one of the issues. I mean, that's why I raised the question to begin with. Back when we first started this, is because folks were asking me, you know, I'd really like to muzzleload hunt, but it's kind of hard for me to see the end of my rifle and put that exactly on target. And these are folks that have hunted all their lives and they like to muzzleload hunt, and yet it's frustrating because they don't see as well as they ought to. And you know, anybody who's 50 years or older knows exactly what we're talking about. It's hard to correct that, regardless of whether you were.
Well, we do have a stipulation in there for those people who don't have the vision. They can get
you can correct your vision to 20/20 with glasses and with contacts, but that doesn't solve the problem right out there. For most folks, it's difficult to see the end of your gun.
I would say that it's been quite some time since we've seen this discussed in a public forum. I think we get, you know, tidbits, you know, individuals contacting us here or there. You know, maybe there's been a shift in public opinion over the last several years. I can't speak to that, but I think that this is the forum where that discussion ought to occur, and at some point we'll get to where we need to be.
Anise, going back to, I think it was this slide here, where you stated you couldn't get enough wasn't enough data for people to really sway it one way or the other. If that's the case in those other states, do you see a big impact in Utah?
I don't see an impact. As I mentioned, I don't think the problem is biological. It's not really an issue.
But can I give you, I've had a fair number of emails on this lately. We've got one member of the public here, and we had a couple of that had to leave earlier that were told they may not be able to speak, but had some thoughts. And here's a little bit of what I've been hearing on this crossbow topic on both sides. One is that there's a fear that crossbows are very popular now. They're on lots of TV shows and movies. You can see them in the Cabela's catalog and so on. If we were to move to allow crossbows in our archery hunts, limited entry, general season deer, there's fear by the archers who have their nice bows that everybody's going to play pile on, and I'll go archery hunting if I can do a crossbow because it sounds cool. I've been watching it on TV, kind of a thing. So there's a fear there. But on the other side of that, and what I've seen a fair number of emails on as of late is people saying, okay, well, we want to go archery hunting as a family in the fall, but my wife doesn't have the physical body strength to hunt with a, you know, a heavier draw compound bow even, or my youth don't, or older folks don't. And so there's been some requests not to just make it yes or no, but maybe offer it, you know, youth up to age 17 or whatever on July 31st, whatever that is, you know. Did I get that right? Okay, whatever. You know, maybe you allow youth to hunt with crossbows because they may not have the body strength, or maybe you allow women at any age, or maybe you allow men over age 60 or 70 or whatever. And that's some of the kind of dialogue I think that our public wants to have. I don't know if this board wants to entertain that or not, but I think it's there's a little more to this discussion than just do we allow crossbows or not. You know, and so maybe if you say, if you address some of those categories, you don't have this major influx of people piling onto the crossbow thing. But there's been an action item. There is an action item on this crossbow thing for carp that isn't even due up yet. And of course, we're having some discussion today. I guess at some point there needs to be a decision. Do you want to really go out and find out, you know, what the public does? The recommendations Tony has probably would go through fine, but I think they would stir up the bigger question because those aren't the, as Jake pointed out, they're not the main categories that people are most upset about. You'll address a few people with the carp and a guy who can hunt his once in a lifetime with a muzzler. You'll tick a few or make a few people off the list kind of happy there, but the masses are looking for that archery during the general season with crossbow weaponry. So that's my comment.
Yes.
Go ahead, John.
I struggle with this. If it was me, I'd take the lid off and let people use what they wanted. I look at it as I got an open sight muzzle loader. I got a deer at 150 yards. I know my gun can shoot that far. Am I going to shoot at him with a scope and kill him? Am I going to shoot at him with open sights or a one-power scope, which is all but a negative magnification, and shoot him in the guts and lose him? I mean, what's more, you know, well, it's unethical. Well, what's more ethical, killing him or wounding him? But, you know, I don't know that we're ever going to solve that problem. And I think it might be time to take this to the public. With crossbows, I just don't understand the fear. I got a good compound bow that at 50, 60, 80 yards is far more accurate than a crossbow. I mean, and if people don't like them because they look like they came out of Star Wars or something, you know, I don't see any harm whatsoever in allowing people to use a crossbow during an any weapon hunt or you know, to shoot carp or a bear out of a tree or something like that, or with a tree stand. I don't see any problem with that whatsoever. It's the perception with a crossbow is that they're lethal, they're deadly, they shoot lights out, and you know they shoot forever. They don't. They're not more accurate than a traditional compound bow. They don't shoot farther, and I think there's a real misconception of what a crossbow can do.
They're the black gun of the archery world.
Yeah, they are.
So are you just saying any weapon hunts or liberalize it in archery and muzzle?
No, I mean, I don't. If somebody wants to hunt with a crossbow, I'd say let them do it during the any weapon hunt. And, you know, I think that would pass, and I think that would be a pill the public could swallow. What I would do personally might be a little bit different than that, but I think that's something that we could do that the public would swallow, and that if somebody wants to hunt with a compound bow, here's your season. It's legal. You can hunt with your compound bow. The guys around you are going to be, you know, shooting different stuff, but that way they have a season. It's legal. Anybody can do it.
Bill.
Yeah, I agree with the sentiment that John's expressed. You know, I have a friend who's an avid bow hunter, makes his own arrows, shoots a recurve, doesn't believe compounds should be allowed, you know, because it's not a real bow. That's like shooting with a rifle, he tells me. So, and muzzle loaders, I remember when they first came out, you didn't dare shoot one beyond 40 yards. And if you could hit a pie plate within 40 yards, you felt pretty good. But now you can shoot, as he mentioned, hundreds of yards. I mean, the weaponry continues to show improvements over time and so forth. So, I mean, but I'm okay with taking baby steps and maybe just doing it during an all-weapons hunt. And then after you see how the social implications are, maybe in subsequent years, you broaden that. You know, I'd like to see more opportunity presented to folks and just kind of see how it goes.
Ernie.
Yeah, I think the division's got a really good proposal here. One of the things I like about it is that I don't see any potential for an increase in harvest over what we're doing presently. So that takes that argument off the table. I totally agree that most of the problems are social, and maybe there's some biological in there, and we don't know. Well, this will give us an opportunity over a couple of years or several years to figure out if there is. If we avidly go after the data to quantify if there's a problem or not, and if there's not, then maybe John's approach, take the lid off, show itself to be warranted, and we can present that data and gain support from the public. But it seems to me the division's approach, or taking a baby step or whatever you want to call it, is a good way to go right now that supports what some of the public is asking for and does no damage to anyone else.
What is the medical accommodation for vision, corrected vision, and the muzzleloader scope?
It's 20/40 corrected.
So that's with corrective lenses of some type.
And there's also the possibility of, under the ADA, anybody can apply under the ADA if, can they not, if they get a doctor certification?
Yeah, we get a couple of requests outside of issues with just 20/40 corrected vision. There's a couple colorblind individuals who call once in a while. We've tried to make decisions on that, and so it does get tough. But we can always review case by case their specific.
Would you let me know how that colorblind deal works out? I'm all over that.
Well, I can see the interest in maybe using crossbows during any weapon season, and I guess I can see some folks wanting to use a magnified scope on a muzzleloader during an any weapon season. I'm not quite sure I see that's not an accommodation in my mind, because that's a choice of a weapon. I mean, you know, I don't see any physical limitations that would prevent you from using that would make it so that using a muzzle loader during that hunt is more advantageous or accommodates some type of a medical need compared to a regular rifle. So a magnified scope on a muzzle loader to me is an accommodation for somebody that's got visual problems.
I think Mike, go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you're not going to make accommodation for visual problems during the regular muzzleloader hunt, then you're eliminating folks from participation, potentially. And, you know, maybe 10 years ago, some of these guys that were adamantly opposed to magnified scopes on muzzleloaders now 50 years old, and they have the same problems that some of these other folks have had for 10 years now. So, I mean, that's my concern.
Our current accommodation is for muzzleloader season. So it does accommodate for magnification during muzzleloader season.
Right.
And crossbows during archery season.
Except that if you have vision that's corrected to 20/40 or better, it doesn't apply to you, right? And there are people with 20 to 40 vision that can't see the end of their guns.
I'm one of them.
Mike?
Mr. Buschman.
Yeah, I hear you. I wear contacts to see at a distance. I wear one set of glasses to see it at 2 feet and one to see it about a foot to get clear vision. And trying to focus on a rear sight and a front sight at a distant target is nearly impossible. Whether nearsightedness qualifies as a disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act, I'm not certain. A lot of people suffer from that. And then it will come down to is, are there reasonable accommodations already built in within the system that negates the need to have to give or provide a magnifying scope? I've never shot through a one power scope, but
it
I would
sucks.
Suggest that it would solve the problem of trying it to focus sucks. On front sight, rear sight, and distant target. I mean, it's not great, I'm sure, but it may solve that problem, and that could be seen as a reasonable accommodation itself. The other possibility is whether in any weapon hunt, allowing a muzzleloader with a magnifying scope would be an accommodation. And lastly, is if if nearsightedness or some other vision malady is considered a disability under ADA and allowing a one-power scope doesn't solve that problem, we would have a legal obligation to accommodate that disability. But there's a few legal issues I'm not positive on, and that's the nearsightedness question.
And I don't know about the one-power scope issue. I've never looked through one, but from what people tell me, it's kind of like looking through the wrong end of binoculars. And even the dots that are in scopes have some issues with some of them, the red dots. So I don't know. I'm just saying the potential is out there to lose people that still have lots of years of hunting out there but can't see well enough to justify going out there without a scope.
Let me give you a little background on the current rule in R-657-12 that allows a magnifying scope as an accommodation for vision disability. We did not allow that a few years ago, and a muzzle loading organization, nationwide organization, filed a complaint with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Utah was one of the states that was included in that complaint. It was an administrative action. As an agency that receives federal aid, we are obliged to follow the Americans with Disabilities Act, or we could have federal aid discontinued. So that complaint went through. All the states responded, gave their various reasons why they thought there was accommodations and a number of other defenses to it. In the end, the Fish and Wildlife Service, through the I'm not sure if it was the U.S. Attorney's Office or Solicitor's Office, came to the determination that they felt that an accommodation needed to be made for magnifying scope with people with vision disabilities. I talked with ophthalmologists, optometrists, and a number of things to arrive at this 20/40 corrected vision. That's the same standard for a driver's license. And felt that was appropriate. We looked at it. We passed the rule. We ran it by the Fish and Wildlife Service, who accepted it as adequate. So that's kind of where we came from and why we're at the magnifying scope provisions on muzzleloaders in the accommodations for disabled people portion.
Any other comments?
The guarantee is when this goes out in a future RAC, is we're going to get a ton of, you are going to get a ton of public input on it. I think that's great. That'll give us the opportunity to look at it again a little later and decide if further changes are warranted.
Well, I think that would be good. If the public gets a chance to comment on that, I think that would be great. I think that's what folks are looking for the opportunity to do.
It'll be a part of Dell and Ernie's legacy.
I guess when you say that would go out, though, typically
fishing killers.
When we go out, we're going to address the topic and then draw a recommendation of that.
A conclusion or something.
You will bring people to these meetings that want this broader scale of things. Right. So although you mentioned maybe we ought to wait a couple of years and see how it plays out, that might be a baseline for the recommendation that Tony or Anise, whoever would present this, would make. But we've got to be prepared for a pretty large dialogue about, you know, crossbows for all, crossbows for youth, all these different, because that's what the numbers of people will show up to these meetings to address.
I
was going to say Ernie's comments were on getting some dialogue and some history behind what will happen with the archery and or the crossbows and the muzzleloaders. I think you'll be able to get that on muzzleloaders, but I don't think with the time of year that you're going to be hunting with a crossbow that you'll ever be able to get enough data to back whether it's good or bad. I don't know.
I was just going to say, I think this proposal, like you've brought it to us here with your recommendations, I'd be very comfortable taking that out. I mean, now. And I think as you do that, we'll get a really good feel for, you know, is it time to look at weapons again in general, you know, to look at expanding or what? I think this would be a really good kind of a measuring stick as to what we might be in for. But I think what you've brought to me simplifies a few rules that I was mistaken on. Mike told me I was a criminal last time because I going to put a 20 power scope on my muzzleloader and shoot a cow elk with it during the general season. He said I couldn't do that. I'd be doing time.
We've been watching you for quite a while, sir.
apparently so. So
that's your proposal then, is to have a scope on a muzzleloader for any weapon, but not the muzzleloader hunt. Muzzleloader hunt is still a primitive weapon. And then crossbows, is that an archery or is that an any weapon?
It would be any weapon.
It would be an any weapon.
Essentially what we're really looking at here is simply redefining what we currently call a legal weapon here in the state.
Any weapon would be any weapon.
Yeah, any legal weapon, absolutely.
Right, okay.
Except the illegal ones.
Except the illegal ones.
Well, one question, Tony. It looks like all the states but us allow that heavier magnified scope on a muzzleloader during these any weapon hunts, but did you hear any feedback from states where they have increased law enforcement issues with, you know, the guy does his spike elk hunt in the fall with that 9 power, and then here comes next year's muzzleloader deer hunt where he's got to go back to a 1 or nothing, and it seems like once you put those scopes on, it's not that fun to pop them on and off all that often.
You know, I didn't get any feedback in that regard. The one thing that was a little eye-opening to me is when I started just doing some searches through Google, how often quick detachable scope mounts were referenced here in the state of Utah. So if you see a conservation officer come and pop off your magnifying scope, or there's a magnifying eyepiece that will screw into the back of a 1 power scope, and I was a little surprised to see those references.
Well, Greg's the director's obviously missing the best part about this whole thing, and that is the fact that you will then have a perfect excuse to go buy another muzzleloader, so you don't have to change your scope.
Well, I think if that proposal that you brought up today goes out, that'll stimulate a lot broader discussion, and maybe you'll get those folks that are really interested in the magnification will come, and they'll let you know. Maybe there'll be 3, maybe there'll be 3,000. Thank you for putting that together.
Okay.
It's helpful.
Anything else on that? Anise, you had any other comments regarding that? And Marty, appreciate your expertise on everything to keep us lined out. Thank you. Our next item number 7, update on the Monroe Mountain Working Group, Gary Bazant and Vance Mumford.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to switch gears here and talk a little bit about trees. And we'll find that I think it's pertinent information and for the Wildlife Board to know about and be prepared for. Okay, Monroe Mountain Working Group. This was formed a couple years ago. Why was it formed? Why did we organize it? The U.S. Forest Service Fish Lake District decided to organize this group to address several issues, and they noted, and across the West this has been noted, but the lack of recruitment and stand health in our aspen stands has become quite evident, and on Monroe Mountain in particular, it seems to be a very big issue. We've got considerable conifer expansion into our aspen stands, and I'll show you some slides later of what happens when the conifers begin to overtop the aspens. The Forest Service wanted to do some large-scale treatments to make a difference in these aspen stands, to rejuvenate them. And anytime you do a large-scale treatment, that could be a fire or a logging event or something similar to that, there can be some big conflicts that come with that. And in the past, they've had a similar project, you know, large-scale habitat treatment on Monroe Mountain that has failed due to litigation by some groups. And what the Forest Service wanted to do was have a big collaboration of all the interested parties to address the broad range of issues and interests and hopefully avoid litigation. So who are we? Our group is moderated by Steve Daniels, professor at Utah State University, and U.S. Forest Service, Sevier and Paiute County Commission, Division of Wildlife, Department of Agriculture, USU Extension, Grand Canyon Trust, State Forestry, Fire, and State Land, local grazing permittees, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, private property people from the Monroe Cabin Owners Association, Farm Bureau, and Brigham Young University researchers. And so we've tried to include all the stakeholders the best we can so everybody can be at the table, express their concerns and ideas, and work out details. So why do we need aspen? Aspen are critical to wildlife species. They're one of the most diverse ecosystems we have here in the West. They benefit. Many species of wildlife depend on them. It's one of the most productive ecosystems we have. A good aspen stand produces large amounts of forage for all kinds of wildlife, but particular, you know, what we're focused on here is wildlife and also livestock. They tend to be a little more fire resistant. Aspen stands do burn, but they tend to be green on top, green on the bottom, and so the fires that do burn through aspen stands tend to be they don't get out of control as easy, and they tend to be a cooler fire. And of course, a healthy aspen stand produces a good hiding cover for young newborn ungulates. So this is the definition that we came up. What do we want an aspen stand to look like? And this is what we came up with. And persistent aspen communities with multi-age stems and adequate recruitment to perpetuate the communities, including site-appropriate biodiverse understories, fire regimes are adequate to perpetuate aspen in areas sterile to conifer. So let me explain what that means. Okay, that just means a good, healthy aspen stand that has young aspen constantly growing up and being recruited into the mature aspen stands. Real quick, aspen biology. It's kind of a relatively short-lived tree. 150 to 200 years is usually maximum on the aspen. Clones can be thousands of years old. Now, an aspen tree isn't just, except in our yard anyway, isn't just a single tree. Its root system can have thousands of trees attached to it, and that's what we call a clone. And most all reproduction by aspens is through suckering. They do produce seeds, but almost all reproduction is by suckering, coming up from the roots, young aspens. And disturbances tend to stimulate that suckering. Natural disturbances include fire, windstorms, avalanches. Anything that disturbs the trees, kills the trees, will stimulate a large amount of growth. Humans can stimulate this growth also. Logging, controlled burns, things like that. And thousands of suckers can be produced per acre. So after a hot fire in a healthy aspen stand, you can have just thousands of young aspen coming up. And then as the trees grow, even though you may have several per square foot, as the stand matures, these aspens will self-thin. Now, there's a lot of reasons why our aspen stands in our forests, particularly, I'm going to focus on Monroe Mountain here, are struggling. I'm just going to focus on two major problems that we have. The picture on the right shows an old aspen stand that is converting to conifers. At this point, at this stage in the game, the conifers are equal to the height of the aspens, and if you were to take a walk through there, you would not find a lot of forage, and it's very thick, difficult to walk through. The picture on the left is some mature aspens, and if you look in there, there's no young aspens. Those trees could be 100 plus years old, and they haven't produced a sucker that has recruited into the overstory for many, many years. And so those are the kind of the two conditions, but either one of those conditions is not a healthy self-perpetuating aspen stand. That one on the left is kind of blinking out. And in another 50 or 100 years or less, we don't know, it may no longer exist. And of course, the trees on the right that are being overgrown by the conifers will probably always have some aspen in it, but it will not be a productive stand. So what has the group been doing? This picture shows just one of our field trips going up on the mountain, on boots on the ground, looking at the trees. They've been doing, we've got four browse, permanent browse transects that we do up there. We go through and see how many aspens are sending or how many aspen suckers are coming up, and what level of browse they've been receiving. And we've done that for 2 years now, and we use photo cameras. They're set up on these transects. We're trying to decide, hey, what's eating these aspen shoots that are coming up? Why are they not being recruited? What's eating them? And what we found is everything eats aspen: deer, elk, cattle, sheep. Aspen tastes good. It's nutritious. It does have some chemical defenses, but many animals like to eat it. And one of the real neat things that we've been able to do with this working group is this new way to manage the livestock grazing on the mountain. We just received funding. The group just received funding for this and approval to put in pump stations, new fences, different water lines, in order to be able to rotate pastures, mostly cattle but some sheep also, to be able to rotate to give us the ability to rest certain pastures. Right now, under the current grazing regime, we're not able to rest these pastures up on top. And under this new system, we'll be able to rest them periodically, which should improve their aspen recruitment as far as the livestock issues are concerned. This is the proposal. We're proposing to treat. Now, treating can mean a lot of different things. 55,000 acres over the next 10 years with a combination of mechanical treatments. That would be like logging, probably not clear cutting, but just cutting out the conifers or cutting the conifers and some of the aspen to stimulate suckering, prescribed fire. Through BYU, they're going to put 60 additional aspen monitoring plots on there, some four-way exclosures, so that as these projects go forth, we can measure success and learn from it, and so in the future we can make better decisions. And addressing overbrowsing of aspen and the lack of fire are two key components of this this project. So how do we treat aspen? I kind of already mentioned we can burn it, we can clear cut it, we can selective cut, cut out the conifers, we can disturb the roots, just cut the roots. One of the big questions we have is, and the BYU study will hopefully answer this, is are we going to do small little projects or are we going to do great big projects? And what are the benefits of each? And but pretty much the treatments that we're suggesting, the group is suggesting, is all of the above. We have to use all the tools that we have and custom tailor it to the particular area. Now here is, I think, why the Wildlife Board should take really take a real interest in this. Is the picture on the left is a clear cut, which stimulated large amounts of aspen suckering when it was first done about 10, 12 years ago. And it was a mixed stand of conifer and aspen. And but what happened over the next 3 years is this area was severely browsed by big game animals. And as you can see, there are no aspen in that clear cut. And there are no new suckers trying to come up. You get 2 to 3 years of active suckering after a large burn or a cut where the roots are shooting up new aspen. And after that, it's used up, and it's used up its energy in the roots, and you can actually lose the root system and the clone. And so there's several instances on Monroe Mountain, both of clear cuts and burns, where the aspen clone has died. So we no longer have that ecosystem any longer. The picture on the right is one of the solutions we have to protect it from grazing or browsing by both livestock and big game animals. But you can see on that fence line there, the part that's protected has really helped the young aspens coming up. And on the other side, we don't have any. Aspen shoots, we consider them safe from browsing when they hit about 6 feet tall. So it takes about 3 to 6 years for these aspen to become safe from browsing. And so fencing is one option that we have to protect it. And we've done that on Monroe Mountain. We just recently had the Box Creek fire, and we did erect an 8-foot fence around large portions of the burned area to protect it from overuse to make sure we get those aspen recruited. We can also protect it by livestock grazing changes. And like I talked about before on the grazing plan changes, that's going to help. Usually after a large burn, it's rested from livestock grazing for 2 years. That's a standard Forest Service policy. And at the same time, we can protect it by reducing big game browsing. And we can do that by hazing, by hunting, or by increasing forage and adjusting the size of the treatments. So as the wildlife biologist over the Monroe unit, this is this comes right in my lap to decide what to do if a fire or a treatment is being overbrowsed by big game animals. And so that's the mission of the Monroe group is to work all this out. The elk herd on Monroe Mountain, as we talked about before, is very valuable, very high interest, and just a ton of recreation is involved with those elk. So it's important that we protect them. Also. There's a lot of other issues when we're talking about what are we going to do to promote aspen. Bonneville cutthroat trout are important. Other sport fisheries on the mountain, boreal toads, sage grouse, goshawks, private property issues, watersheds, wilderness areas, and livestock grazing like we've always already talked about. So all those need to be considered when we're talking about any projects that we're going to do. Just real briefly, we won't spend much detail on this, but funding is important. A lot of the grazing improvement of the infrastructure is quite expensive, but long term, I think very valuable. The monitoring We got money for that, and mechanical treatments that that we need to do before we burn are also expensive. There's a lot of private ground on Monroe Mountain, and if you're doing controlled burns, you need to make sure that we don't burn up private ground, private property, or you know, houses and cabins. And so before I go into questions, so I like to point out, because I'm sure this will be one of them, is where the Wildlife Board comes in. The Monroe Mountain Working Group, if they have a large treatment that is being over, we're not getting recruitment, in other words, the elk or deer are coming in and browsing off the aspen, we may have to suggest some hunts. And so the Monroe Mountain Group can make recommendations to the board, to me as a biologist, to possibly do something about that. And so that's where we wanted you guys to be prepared if any of that comes down the pike in future years. I'll probably talk a little bit more in a minute, but right now, what kind of questions or concerns do you guys have about what I've talked about?
Yeah, thank you for the presentation. How many permittees are on Monroe Mountain?
I couldn't tell you the number of different.
But they're all part of the collaboration on this?
They have selective. They've got about two members, I believe, that have been coming, and they meet together. They have a grazing association. They meet together.
And the Forest Service has kind of bought in the idea of establishing these pastures and this fencing to be able to rotate their livestock around under the prescribed number of days grazing. And so will all the permittees be in a particular allotment at that same time, and then they all get pushed off to the next one and so forth? Is that how that's
going
to work?
Well, they won't all be on the same allotments at the same time, because there is quite a few allotments on the...
So there's enough spacing that... Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yep, correct.
And who monitors the grazing to make sure that the browsing doesn't become more or less than what you might want in a particular area?
As far as the cattle grazing, the Forest Service has range professionals that monitor the range use. And as far as wildlife browsing goes, the Forest Service would help us. It would be a collaborative effort. The working group would be watching really close, and I would be watching close on those areas.
And has the water distribution system been built and set up, or is that still yet one of
the projects? That is still coming.
Okay. And the fencing and so forth.
And the fencing and everything, yes.
But the money's been allocated for both.
The money has been allocated. Jason Kling, he's the district ranger with the Fish Lake National Forest there. He's with me, and he can answer some of the technical questions if I got everything right so far, Jason.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I, you know, up on Deseret, they use this savory method, this rotation method. It works out beautifully. It's just great. So I'm glad to see this being implemented here.
I've got a question.
Yes.
A couple of them. How much does it cost you to fence 8-foot game-proof fence on those things, and how many acres are you talking about, or how many linear feet are you going to have to fence on some of those?
Hey, Jason, you want to come up here and talk a little bit about that? It's very expensive, but I can just explain that the Box Creek Fire that we just put the fence up on, it's very critical areas for elk calving, mule deer, everything. So it was very important that we saved this burn area and that. So can you tell us about the expense on that? Acres?
Yeah, with the Box Creek Fire last year, gosh, we built about 11 miles of 8-foot tall fence, and that 11 miles cost us almost $300,000. So it's more than $5 a foot. And that 11 miles got us about 600 acres. So you could just imagine if we were trying to fence 55,000 acres and what that would cost. Our answer is to try and get to a point where we're not dependent upon fencing for success simply for that financial reason, as you can.
My other question is, a couple of years ago, it seems like I saw some type of a report, maybe that it was your group had put together. But do you have a publication that kind of overviews what you're trying to do? And if so, can we get a copy of that? I don't know if you have anything like that. Or an annual report. I don't know.
Yeah, well, right now with the two projects that Vance talked about, for example, with the first one, the range, improvement, pastures, water developments, and all that kind of stuff, has been through the NEPA process, signed a decision. That is on our web and available for public review and provides all that detail. And then for the larger 55,000-acre prescribed fire mechanical, we're currently in the process of doing an EIS. And so maybe that's what you saw, a notice of intent that came out back in October and November. And we've been holding public meetings, and soon a draft EIS will be coming out. And so that's also available and will be available. I'm not sure if that's what you were.
I don't think it was an official publication. Somebody at Utah State and Logan.
It's probably the Aspen guidelines.
That could be what it was.
That was put out, and it's not specific to Monroe Mountain, but it's just a book that was put together to give us guidelines, not just anybody guidelines on how to treat Aspen, what to look for, and we're actually using that document in our discussions.
I didn't see a bullet in there as a possible control mechanism, a reintroduction of wolves. Is that
no.
Just kidding.
I don't anticipate
negative.
That.
Don't bring that
no.
up.
So,
no.
A question, Vance. Sure. So this whole Monroe group is, for both of you, is going to learn some things, and it's good. And we know that Aspen's important, and we've got to move forward. But you know, this is a pretty small area compared to our whole state where you've got grazing. So we'll recover some aspen in some areas, and that will be good, but expensive. How do we move forward with this statewide? I just got back from a meeting with Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation in Missoula here a couple hours ago, and there was a fair dialogue with other states, Colorado, Idaho, others, on this very matter of aspen you know, as long as you've got these large ungulates out there, they're going to go after aspen. They've been doing it for thousands of years. So where do we go from here? We're going to do this sort of myopic view of what could be better on the mountain. But if you got cows and elk and deer up there eating it, you're maybe never going to fully achieve this. I realize you can recover an area. You can take the fencing down, and hallelujah, there's a good feed area. But we can't do that in the whole state. So where do we go 5 years from now when we've shown this all works without killing all of our elk off?
No,
we're not going to do that.
No, good question. And like I said, the elk herds are extremely valuable to all of us. And I think where we go from here is lessons learned is how big of a project do we need to do in order to make so many new aspen shoots that we don't have to control elk numbers, or at least in any large number. And so that's one of the questions we can answer. Or if we do need to control elk numbers or deer numbers, how many? What's the best timing of if you're going to have a special small hunt to protect, say, a 5,000-acre burn or a 10,000-acre burn? How intensively do you have to hunt? Hunt those elk to kind of encourage. You wouldn't want to necessarily shoot them all, but by having hunts, we've already discussed today how we can move elk, and so we can look at, I think, how intensively do we need to hunt an elk herd in order to move them, encourage them to go use other areas while this area is recovering. What are your thoughts, Jace?
I'm also thinking about the aspen restoration guidelines that were recently published a few years ago, which were some guidelines for national forest here in the state of Utah. And then from those guidelines, there's a few pilot projects, this being one of four or one of three, the biggest of those three, that is testing those guidelines to see what we can learn and where we can adapt and where we can improve. And I would venture to say that, you know, we're going to learn a lot from Monroe Mountain that we may be able to apply to other areas of how we can do this. You're right, though. I mean, it is more, it's a bigger issue than just what's on Monroe Mountain.
It's in the whole West, really, yeah. I think, right now.
At least it is.
Many other states describe, you know, this aspen challenge that we've got, but how do you go, you know, Colorado, who's got 260,000 elk right now and having similar issues, you know, those are pretty big on the landscape. At some point, somebody's going to have to make a call what they love the most. You know, obviously we're going to try to navigate through the optimum blend of what can we do to treat these, keep our aspen healthy and strong, because that is a food source that we can't ignore.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the sake of our elk herds, you know, where is that trade-off? So.
Yeah, good question. And I want to make one point. If you picture that mountain and you picture half of the aspen is being overtopped, crowded out by conifers, okay? So in other words, say half of our aspen is just not producing much food right now at all and getting worse every year. And if we can treat a very large portion of that, we've almost doubled the amount of forage that's available out there, the number of aspen shoots and everything. And so it's not just about what you treat, it's about spreading out the number of elk, spreading out the pressure. And so if you have a burn and you have 10,000 shoots per acre, you know, we can have half of that browsed off every year as long as we get enough growing up to replace the stand.
Are you going to harvest some of that conifer too? Is that, you know, timber cutting, is that going to be part of the project as well?
You know, timber, I'll let Jason address that. That's one of the challenges that we have, is how are we going to treat this? And if we do harvest timber, is there people that aren't going to want that to happen for various reasons? And is that timber valuable, really valuable? And a lot of it, to be honest, I don't think is very valuable. So.
Yeah, that's certainly something that we're looking at. When we talk about mixed conifer on Monroe Mountain, we're talking primarily subalpine fir, which doesn't have much of a market to it. And so at the same time, we know that if we're going to do some big prescribed burns, and knowing that you have private property and cabins and houses at the top of the mountain, we're going to have to do some mechanical treatments at the tops there around those private properties so that we can do those fires safely. And we've been doing that on a small scale, and we're able to do it. It's costly, where you were actually paying people to remove it because there's not a market out there where they want to come take it on their own. We've got some other things in the pipeline, potential biomass plant that might be coming into the area that could provide a new market that we're hopeful for. But certainly that's one of the options.
A couple of questions. What's the definition of your large scale when you're doing this treatment?
Okay, good question. I don't think we have an actual definition of large scale, but I would. It's in the realm of thousands of acres, and so the plan right now is about 55,000 acres in 10 years, and so if it works out how it's supposed to, approximately 5,000 a year, you know, for 10 years, and the first 5,000 acres isn't, well, that's still pretty big, it's not huge, but after 2 and 3 years you're looking at, you know, 10 or 15,000 acres, and you're getting quite large. That's kind of my thoughts on large scale.
So, at the end of the day, whether it's 10 years or 16 years, being you have to rest before some animals can come back on it, is the grazers guaranteed their AUMs when all this is over? Or if some of those sites didn't take off, or is there going to be cutbacks, or is it the same on the hunting side or the elk? What's the downside?
You want to address the livestock first, Jason?
Well, I mean, obviously our hope is that we don't have to do that. It's nobody's desire to do that. Be unfortunate if we have to do that. It's critical that know, as we do these projects and as we do these burns, and as Vance discussed earlier, those first 2 or 3 years are really, really critical because those aspen walnut have so much energy to send up those sprouts. And if we can get through that first couple years and get to that 6 to 7 feet above the browse height, then we'll be safe in terms of, you know, long run and down the road. If, I guess, you know, the worst thing that could happen is it all get munched on the first 3 years and we completely lose that aspen and that habitat and it's gone forever, would be the worst thing. And so we have thought and have assumed that there's going to be some short-term impacts and some inconveniences, and with the idea that if we can get through those first couple of years immediately after a treatment, down the road we're going to be so much better off than where we are today. But hopefully not. You know, I mean, I'd hate to see permanent cuts like that happen. We're trying to get to where that we wouldn't be in that position.
So, in listening into the last conversation over the phone, it wasn't last night, it was a couple of weeks ago or whatever, you talked about, and I can't remember the number, I'm just going to throw a number out, say you had 9,000 different areas where aspen would come up. If you have failures in certain amount of those, that going to relate back to the grazers and the elk being on the mountain at the end of the day, though, is my question? Or are we going to go back to the historical or what we have there now? Is that going to be allowed? I guess my question is, if you have the failures, are we going to be able to have those elk back there?
Okay, good question. I can kind of address the wildlife side of it. And so so I think a fear and actually a concern of mine is, too, we do some treatments and the aspen's struggling. It's getting hit really hard. And then we start harvesting some elk, have some special hunts. It's still not working. And then do these elk hunts become permanent? You know, are we permanently reducing the number of elk on Monroe Mountain? And that's something that I don't want to see. I think there's plenty of forage on Monroe Mountain for the objective that's there. It's just the aspen that is struggling right now, not necessarily the amount of total forage on the mountain. And so as far as the wildlife's concerned, we'll use all the tools we can, hazing, dogs, special hunts to try to guarantee, we can never guarantee anything, but to make the chances of the treatment a success. And a little earlier, I think you might have been talking about the thresholds on that phone call, that phone conference. We have some thresholds. So in other words, if after the first year, if we're having great regeneration and 50% of the aspen sprouts have been browsed, I'm just pulling that number out. But as long as we're still getting recruitment, you know, I don't think we need to increase anything. But if the thresholds are met, in other words, or are not being met, we're getting too much browse, then we need to make adjustments. But I think if we plan it right, we do big enough treatments, I think we can be successful without too much harvesting of elk. And deer eat aspen also, but we're not, definitely not talking about harvesting any deer for the aspen, just elk. And of course, that would be all up to the Wildlife Board and the regional advisory councils as far as any permit approvals or anything like that.
Yeah. I think it's all interesting, all well and good to get the trees, get the habitat going. My big concern is, you know, it's real easy to remove the livestock. I mean, you pick up the phone and say, you, sorry, you just got cut off your permits, find someplace else to go. Too bad for you. It's not that easy to remove the elk.
Right.
I mean, if you start moving, I mean, yeah, you can do a little bit of hazing. You start having a hunt and take off 80% of the elk, there's going to be a big pushback. The livestock don't have that much. You can't push back. I mean, like I say, you make a phone call, sorry, you're off your permit for 3 years until this reestablishes. I think there needs to be some consideration to make things equal. I mean, if you're going to pull them off to rehabilitate something, find someplace else for them. Give them some consideration that way. Don't just take them, you know, just tell the rancher, hey, sorry, you're out of luck. Help him relocate somewhere for a short term.
And that's one of the things that this range project is going to help us do, is where we're combining some allotments. And so now a permittee is not only restricted to three or four pastures within his particular allotment, but now he or she can go to those pastures north or south, so that when we are burning in that particular piece of land, they have another place to go.
I'm going to say, is it up in Rich County where they've combined allotments? Instead of having, you know, 15 different allotments in 15 different places, they've combined a lot of these and done the your rest rotation like the Deseret has done.
Yeah, Duck Creek.
Duck Creek. That was it. Thank you. You know, are there plans to do something similar to that down
there? This is very, very similar.
Very similar to the same thing, combining allotments to move things around.
Yep.
So that nobody gets shortchanged. Sorry, you can't graze, but you can. But, you know, combining things and doing some things.
Department of Agriculture and Food is on the Monroe Mountain Working Group.
Okay.
And of course, they've got experience up north in Rich County and with Deseret, and have been bringing a lot of those ideas. And that's part of this range project, yes.
Good. Okay.
Well, I want you to know before you cut in that I'm all for it. Habitat improvement is great. Always hindsight is better. Wished we'd started years ago. But at the end of the day, we want to make this thing succeed, and the least amount of time is critical.
Are there some test areas that are that will be treated that won't have any restrictions from cattle and elk? It sounds like one of the points you addressed is if this is on a landscape, a statewide, I think you mentioned it'll give you an idea of what can happen. So obviously we're not going to fence the whole state, as we've talked about. So are there some areas you would just treat and just see what happens when they're getting pounded? Because that might be more reflective of what the rest of the state would really look like moving forward, which is a burn goes through, a control burn, or a mechanically treated area, and that you just let it sit. So.
Yeah, and that brings up a good point. With the monitoring that BYU and Dr. Sam St. Clair is going to be doing, and with these four-way exclosures that he's putting in, the only way that he's really going to be able to learn what he's trying to learn from a four-way exclosure is if livestock have the ability to play its role in that. And so although it's not typically something that we do, because we're trying to provide that rest and allow those areas to recover, I think that in some site-specific areas, research-specific, it may be good to do that. And I know that he's brought that up and is suggesting that in some
That's
areas.
That's part of the study now,
yeah.
The way it's written.
Part of the overall monitoring plan with BYU that they're going to be helping us with.
And I believe there's about 60 plots spread throughout the mountain also that won't be exclosures, but they will be monitoring plots. Is that correct, Jason?
Yeah, it's more like 120. So we've got 60 tied to the range project, and then about another 60 tied to the fire mechanical. So we're going to have a grad student up there for the next 4 or 5 years and some undergraduates, and really taking a good hard look at this.
Vance, I'm sorry, but I made one other note as we was going through the slides. I seen an objective about halfway through, it said a shorter season for cattle or for livestock. And I might have missed what we were talking about. Can you go back about 4 or 5 screens
and
see if we can pick that up? I think it's
this one right here. Okay. They're underneath objective, achieve shorter grazing periods. By having more pastures and the ability to rotate, you can adjust the time that the cows are in there, not just the number of days, but the timing of the season. And so if the cattle tend to graze on aspen a certain time of year, more so than others, you know, that may be a possibility to adjust the timing of that.
you can do some things with moving, you know, bunching up instead of spreading, you know, X number of animals over a large area, bunch them up. Just what you said, you know, let's avoid this area at this time, so we're going to kind of bunch them and, you know, do an intensive grazing in one area for a short period of time and then move them somewhere else and let that have its chance to regrow. So that and it goes back to that, to the working group and to the Duck Creek in Deseret, what they're doing in Rich County.
Yep, that's it. And with this project, we've got four allotments that we'd be doing that on.
We'll be combining four allotments together.
And then those livestock would be managed as a larger group. So more numbers in an area for a shorter period of time, so you get that higher use. But then you have a longer period of rest before they get back to that pasture again 12 or 18 months later. And then when they do get back to that pasture, it may not be the same time of year. So one year it could be in the spring, and another year it could be in the fall. So you're changing that season of use and your timing. The water, having dependable water, and allows us to do that, because currently some pastures don't have water.
And if I could just bring up really quick, the antlerless hunt recommendations that were made for Monroe Mountain this year. Typically, we don't hunt hardly any cow elk on Monroe Mountain because of what we talked about earlier. Our winter counts are below objective, and so typically we don't hunt them there. But this year, in order to help ease the number of elk that are on Mount Dutton that are difficult to harvest, we're going to be recommending to harvest some elk on Monroe Mountain this year. And one of those hunts is right on the top middle portion of Monroe Mountain, where we are seeing the highest impact on aspen. And so that's my recommendations for the Monroe antlerless hunt were several fold: help reduce the number of Mount Dutton elk, help the aspen out a little bit, and also to curb some depredation issues that we're having.
Question, Ernie?
Yeah. I got a couple of things for you. Vance, I didn't see on your slide on projects any Habitat Council, any conservation permit, and only a minuscule amount of watershed projects.
It wasn't entirely inclusive on there of everything.
I would think conservation permit money ought to be a solid source, a big contributor.
You know, possibly. I think Jason can clarify, but we'll be seeking, you know, for the next quite a few years, funding sources for these projects, and that may be a place that we could search for those.
There's currently a proposal in there now for some watershed restoration money, and we didn't include it because we haven't heard back yet on whether or not for this 2013, and then definitely down the road, 14, 15, 16, we'll be looking for those opportunities.
I would think both those sources ought to be players.
Yep.
And second question, you talked that you need to get the aspen through the first couple of years in particular. Suckers.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also said that they had to get to 6 feet. And you said that grazing is typically restricted for 2 years. Do they reach 6 feet in 2 years?
Obviously, it depends on the site and moisture and so forth. It's usually 2 to 3 to, we've been saying 3 to 6 years before they get to that 6 feet. We don't typically rest for 6 years. That's a long time to rest from livestock grazing. It's not uncommon to rest it for 2 to 3 years. Get beyond 3 years, it gets difficult, because obviously then you've got all those other animals in other areas, and then you're having impacts there. So
you do have alternative banked, if I could use that word, range. It's available to support permittees in the event of a fire or something. And that's fairly routine, isn't it? Couldn't those be used to keep the permittees fully accommodated on their AUMs until the seedlings or the suckers are up to 6 feet? I'm not fully understanding when you say banked, because right now, pretty much all of Monroe Mountain gets grazed. There is no areas on Monroe that doesn't get grazed.
Is that a BLM thing and not a forest?
Monroe Mountain's all Forest Service, isn't it?
For the most part.
Well, where the aspen are.
Yeah, where the aspen are.
How about the concept of alternative reserved allotments that are not allotted? Yeah, we don't have any on Monroe.
So is your question that after 2 years, if we still need to restrict livestock grazing, are the permittees just out in the cold, or is there other options, Jason, to feed their cattle? Is that what your concern is?
Yes, I'm thinking more of BLM, but they typically have got reserved areas, and the minute you get a big fire, rangeland.
Not necessarily. Some places do, but some places don't. Depends on if there's additional grazing or not. You know, a lot of times they'll, if you get burned out, we'll see you in 2 years. You've got a 2 year, you're mandatory off for 2 years. Good luck. Some places they do have a bank where you can pool your sources, but not always. That's a rare occasion.
So I think these projects, we're going to try to time them so that we don't run into that situation and time it right, and hopefully it'll work out.
Any other questions?
Okay, thanks for your time.
Thank you, man.
Thanks, Vance. Appreciate that.
Other business? You want to bring it up, Ernie?
Okay. We're at that point where we need to start thinking about board elections for a new chair and vice. There's two options to do it, where those individuals get a little bit of time to prepare and to come in and talk with Marty and Stacy and get organized on how they're going to run meetings and the legal stuff that they need to know. Those would be May 29th, our work meeting, or June 4th, our board meeting. And then there's two options where whoever is the new chair is going to get thrown in the pot of water like a lobster. And it will already be boiling, and that's August 21st and 22nd. And August 21st is already taken up with the general board and RAC training, I believe, as well as some portion of a work meeting, so that's not much of a day. The board has done this multiple ways, multiple times, over multiple years. So Dell and I talked a little bit last night, and we kind of think it's up to the incumbent or the continuing board members, those of you that are going to live with the results of this decision, decide what you'd like to do as acceptable with the division. I would add that I understand that on the May 29th work session, Calvin may not be there. Probably won't be there as of this point. On June 4th, the last scheduled board meeting at this point where Dell will be presiding, theoretically all of us will be attending that meeting.
There's a pretty good chance I won't be at that work session as well with Calvin. So
let's do it on the June 4th meeting then.
We don't want to vote on that unless we have you all there.
I think the June 4th meeting would be all right, wouldn't it?
And would you like me to contact and see if I can get a list of people that are volunteering either or both positions serve as a sort of quasi-nominating committee or something and clear that with Dell and then get a list out to you in advance of...
Got a question for you. Is there any precedent set as to, is it the those that have served on the board the longest, like Jake and Bill only got a couple years left, that they would be chairman or?
No, there is no rule, there is no precedent.
And we as a board decide who is the chair and who's the vice chair?
You'll decide in secret ballot with the director and Stacy and perhaps the outgoing chair counting the ballots and telling you who was elected.
Why wouldn't the people who are interested notify you at the work session on May and go through the ballot on June the 4th or whatever?
And
at that time they could meet with Marty and Stacy if you got any other things they wanted to go through or whatever at that work session. Uh-huh.
The session with Marty, as I remember it, took several hours.
But if I remember right, when we voted Dale in, you might have met with Marty afterwards, but did you do it before?
I don't remember it.
Well, I don't think so.
I was going to say, I don't think I need to talk to candidates. Once
a
chair
to talk
is
to
selected,
them.
Then we need to sit down and talk a
no,
little bit.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
After the election is done.
Right.
And the way I got it from you is you want to do it before.
No. Absolutely not.
By that time, they're already stuck.
Nothing I can do.
Well, that's going to be after.
I guess there's a few things we need to consider. Whoever is vice chair will be taking on that big pile of paperwork that Ernie's got there. Is that right? Action log and Ernie
answering
and Ernie responds to all the emails kind of for us collectively as a board. And I mean, there's a lot of work.
So how are you going to get anybody to run for that?
Well, John has a way with words.
Oh, negative. I am not interested in either spot.
There's
nor
nothing,
as I think, are the rest of you interested in having me in either spot. So
that was just a created thing a few years ago. There's nothing in concrete on that. You can alter that to divvy them around
however,
or something if you want to.
Okay.
Pardon? I was the only retired
Ernie was just
one,
a
so
good
I,
choice and had the time to do that.
The chair and vice chair could just delegate that to John.
You what?
I said the chair and vice chair could delegate that responsibility.
You don't want me
to John.
Doing anything that takes clerical savvy whatsoever.
So if it's okay, then what I will do is I'll contact each of the continuing board members and ask if you're interested and willing to put your name in the hat for chair or vice chair. And then I'll distribute a ballot. Out to you, listing those that have said they'll do it, and then we get to the June 4th meeting and have a vote.
Is that how we did it, or do we have a nominating?
Last time we did it was just during the meeting. It took about a half hour, and we were done.
Yeah. That's what I think. It was just nominating.
Half hour now?
I got another question for you on the process, I guess. If somebody, say Calvin, gets put in as chairman, do you re-up that every 2 years, or would he be in there until the millennium comes and he's off the board? 2 years. Every 2 years you re-elect.
Correct, Marty. It's a two-year.
Two-year position?
Two-year.
Yeah.
I thought we have revoted every 2 years.
I'm not sure of that.
We did for the RAC.
Yeah.
RAC chairs have a limit of two
My experience was just, I'm not aware that that was there.
I think the reason you voted every 2 years is because those people were going out.
Yeah, I just...
We did redid that rule a while ago. Maybe we better look. But are you positive that nothing on the board? Okay.
I think historically...
Was Max My Morgan was Mac Morgan chair for life, or was he?
Quite a while.
Quite a while.
Seemed like life.
Did they re-vote?
I don't remember them re-voting to stay him in a position he'd already had. I don't recall, but that was 15 years ago.
A long time ago.
Just saying, because that's a, I mean, that's a, if you get somebody in there, I mean, 4 years. You can get pretty stale after 4 years.
You can get pretty stale after two.
I'm just saying.
Okay, how about we ask Stacy to please get us that answer?
And
send it out.
Marty's already found it. There you go. Right there.
The two-year term limitation for a chair is on the rack. Chair, there is nothing that I can see on the wildlife board. There's precious little written about the wildlife board's policies and how they conduct business other than statute.
So it isn't stipulated either way?
There is no restriction. They can serve it for the full 6 years of their, term as a board member or a lesser period. The board, I mean, if you wanted to say it was a two-year term.
You could have a new chairman every meeting.
Just rotate up and down the table.
That'd be awesome.
Every month you just sit on the next chair to the right.
Okay.
Every month we just rotate.
And did I hear you just as soon defer identifications at the ballot until the meeting itself?
Yeah.
That's fine. I don't.
Okay.
Yeah, let's just on that June 4th meeting, when we're about done other business. We'll just take nominations for them and those that are interested. You know, that needs to be worked out ahead of time. Then we can just hurry and make a selection. We'll be done.
Marty.
That's about what we did, wasn't it, Ernie?
That was what we did 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Could they vote, since there's not a lot written one way or another, could they, at their option, vote to have that be a two-year term for the chair and vice chair?
I believe so.
Yeah, you probably
internal
could.
Stipulation.
So that could be
board.
Something that you could.
I don't know if it's a big deal. I was just wondering if that's what it was, or if it's.
Well, some of you may not want to.
There's no
do
impeachment
that for
process,
ever, you know.
Well, I just in my 6 years, we've had three different chairs, and the chair was always
at the end of their
fourth
term.
Year man, you know.
Yeah.
Just thinking about it, you know, on the high council, you kind of rotate around, you know, the senior man's kind of the guy, but I was on the high council, dude. Yes, I was.
I wouldn't equate this to the high council.
How far did
call
you
Marty
make
up here. Let's excommunicate him.
How far did you make it around the table?
You made it to 15, right?
I was third from the end. I made it all the way around. There was three guys left after me when I got released, yeah.
What that means is he didn't get called as bishop.
It's terrible.
June 4th for the voting, and Stacey's, no, we eliminated that. That's it.
Yeah.
June 4th.
I think that's good. Are we done?
We're done.
Aye.
9 o'clock tomorrow.
I have one more question. This is very important before the meeting tomorrow, since Marty's right there. Mitigation tag, does it require a hunting license?
What kind of mitigation tag?
Well, say elk.
A voucher or the
there's
okay,
free or
not
fee.
A depredation tag, but a mitigation tag.
Not a mitigation permit, but
yeah.
A mitigation.
Say Vance gave me two tags. Do I have to have a hunting license?
Right. I mean, the statute was to obtain hunting permit. Let me read it to you.
Judy, didn't we end up with the free ones that we would give to a landowner don't need a hunting license, and the ones that we give to a landowner, they have to go redeem and buy at our office? They have to have a hunting license.
That's,
I think
that's the voucher that you redeemed.
Yeah, so I think the free ones didn't have to have anything.
If you just get a free mitigation tag.
Yeah, we went through this number of years.
Can I just go out and take that animal?
Yeah.
That's what you're asking.
Yeah. Do I need a license for that?
For the free one? It's probably been 5 or 6 years ago, but I think we decided you didn't.
Okay, second part of that question then is, if I'm not required to have a license and you got to go to this gentleman's property to hunt, he going to get a ticket for hunting if he comes like the back road with on a four-wheeler or whatever type of deal, you know? Is that an extreme? But
I would, you know, just like when you're driving anywhere, you know, if you're not on the ground hunting.
But what I'm saying is if you put a limit on how far those people can go off their property tomorrow to hunt, and they're coming in there to hunt or whatnot, is that going to cause a problem? Do you have to have a hunting
license?
Is this
the category of permits we're talking about tomorrow?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
These ones that you can go off aren't free ones. They're not free. You'd have to buy those. There's some that we can give to landowners that are free, and some that we give them to the ones that we've been talking about, this change, are ones they'd have to pay for. So they would need a hunting license for those.
Those,
yeah.
Those are the vouchers that you take in exchange.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you got to go pay $45 if it's a cow out, and you do need a hunting license for that. Yeah. The free ones are normally a guy with the haystacks, like, we'll say, here, shoot one of these cow out tonight. It can't be transferred out of the family. It's got to be used by them. And
it's issued directly to a landowner, an immediate family member, an employee.
Yeah. No transferability.
They're
to
the
others.
Ones that have to use.
That's
it
the
personally.
Mitigation permit, and then there's a mitigation voucher, which the landowner can designate themselves or anybody
voucher,
else.
I can give it to you, or I can sell it to you for whatever you're willing
and
to pay.
Then whoever has that voucher and wants to redeem it has to go buy a hunting license.
Right.
Or buy a,
you give,
excuse
me,
a, buy
if you
a
give
permit.
Me the mitigation permit because it's in my haystack, me and my family can just go.
And whether we give a free hunting permit or hunting license for this for the purpose of getting a big game permit, I'm not quite sure. But the statute says to obtain a big game hunting permit, you've got to have a hunting or combination license.